The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Well, the show your pastor warned you about is Stand to Reason. I'm Jim Wallace sitting in for Jay, Jay Warner Wallace. I got to remember to do that because Greg always asks me to use my longer version of my name. So I'm Jim Wallace, also known as Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel, who's usually here with you every Sunday from 2 to 5 p.m. and 3 to 5 p.m. on the American Family Radio Network, which is really kind of a cool aspect of this. We get to be heard all over the country for 2 hours. That begins in the next hour. Greg, this week is in Hungary, and I know that he'll have a lot of stories because already he's starting to email back to us, and there's a lot of cool things going on over there. He's at a conference where he's training up Christians to defend what they believe, and I can tell you he's going to have a lot of good stories to share when he gets back. But if you're getting on the queue here so you can actually join us in the conversation, I would appreciate you giving us a phone call right now so you can get in line. Toll free, 1-800-227-5278. And locally here for this first hour in our local footprint, it's 714-754-4150. I'm also tweeting with you here online on Twitter, and would love to talk to you as you call in with any question you have on anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. As you know, we kind of pride ourselves on the fact this is basic training for your mind, clear thinking Christianity. So give me a call here and we'll get in line and we'll talk about the things that are challenging us as Christians in our culture today. And, you know, I can't tell you over the last, 2 weeks or so, the number of email that I've received through my website at Please Convince Me related to same-sex marriage. And this, of course, is something where I think most of us have been rather prophetic in this area. Greg certainly has, and I know I've talked about this too. I do think that this area is something we're simply going to have to examine and be ready to confront as we go forward, because this may be the one issue that will divide not only our culture, but it may end up also dividing the church. So let me just spend a minute, if I can, with you, because, you know, every time you talk to people on this issue, if you're in a conversation either online or at a family gathering or with a friend of yours at work, and you're talking about this issue and the person you're talking to is a proponent of same-sex marriage, I think we find ourselves having to constantly respond to the kind of soundbite arguments that the media might make, these short, pithy, powerful rhetorical statements that are used to kind of support the position of those who would try to advance same-sex marriage and legalize same-sex marriage and recognize it in all the states across the union. And you hear, you know, statements that are always made are thrown at us, those of us who support a traditional marriage. You'll hear these statements like, you know, why would you folks deny people the right to be in a committed relationship, or why would you prohibit people from loving whomever they want? And I've heard this, I can't tell you on how many talk shows over the last 10 days, as those of us who support traditional marriage are being challenged by those who support same-sex marriage. And these have some rhetorical value, because it's hard to say that, you know, are we really in a position where we're saying we want to deny someone the right to be in a committed relationship? Well, of course we're not saying that. And as a matter of fact, you typically will see people take one aspect of marriage and argue that this is the entirety of marriage, as if the marriage license is what allows you to have a committed relationship, or as if a marriage license is what allows you to love somebody. And, of course, that is not the case. We would argue that marriage is something else entirely. So what I've tried to do is to think, how can I, in a rather short three-step process, argue for the traditional view of marriage that we hold as Christians without having to resort to what I know is true from Scripture? Because most people I'm dealing with are just as I was for 35 years. They don't accept the statements that you find in Scripture. They don't accept what the Bible says about any of this. If you're going to make a case with someone like me 15 years ago, you'd have to be able to make it on kind of a thoughtful, rational, philosophical basis without resorting to any Scripture. Because the minute you do that, 15 years ago, I would have turned off my ears to hearing anything there. Now, I think there's a difference for us when we're challenged to support what we believe about same-sex marriage. We take one approach with those who identify themselves as Christians, right? I mean, if someone says, I'm a Christian who supports same-sex marriage, I'm a Christian who has a different view about homosexuality or a different view about marriage than you silly traditionalists have, I think that's where we're going to have to make a biblical case. And I've tried to do that, and Greg certainly has, at str.org. I've done that also in our Hot Topics section at Please Convince Me. This is an opportunity for us to talk to other Christians about what it is that Scripture clearly says about this issue. And so we make that kind of biblical case to those brothers and sisters in the faith, because it is clear, I think, clear of biblical teaching in this area. But I think that's different than the kind of case we make with secular challengers who really, I think, if you asked me, I would have demanded a philosophical, reasonable approach. So let me give you some ideas about how you might take three steps in trying to make a case for traditional marriage. The first step is one that I discussed at length a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, with Frank Turek over coffee. And he made a good point of impressing upon me the simple power of, and we talked about this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when I was here, of the three P's, about what every government can do and ought to do, the role that every government should play in the activities and behaviors of its citizens. I think government can do one of three things. It can prohibit, permit, or promote certain basic activities. Now, look, most of us are grateful that government steps in and prohibits some illegal activities that they would say, and we would agree, have long-term harm on our culture. So, for example, we're glad, you know, that government comes in and steps in and stops the abuse of children or pedophilia or any other kind of victimization, rape or unjustified homicides. These are the kinds of things we're happy to see government step in and prohibit. But there are lots of things that we would say that the government, and I think we would probably say this is the largest group, those things that government ought to permit. That's really the vast majority of activities, if you think about it. And even some of these activities might be considered immoral. Let me give you an example. I think we would say that government, you know, we ought to be free to speak our minds on certain issues, on every issue that wouldn't jeopardize the safety of other citizens. We ought to be able to pursue our dreams, live wherever we want. Opportunities ought to be afforded to us. But we're even free in our country to commit adultery if we like. So there are certain things that the government decides it will permit, and it must, of course, in making this decision, what's the long-term harm, and is it something that the government should step in to prevent? Now, keep in mind, there are also some things that governments choose to promote. So governments pick activities. I'll give you an example. In almost every institution, government sees an ideal that it wants more of, and that it attempts to promote that ideal so that it can get more of that. So, for example, if we're looking at business models, our government typically wants to see a business model in which if the choice is to be made between employing citizens here in this country or shipping all the jobs offshore, government will often come in and incentivize in some way the business so that it can keep its jobs here in America. It might give it tax breaks, allow it certain regulations be lightened or removed. Different incentives that will help the business to do what it is government thinks is in the best interest of the culture long term. And so it promotes these forms of business because it thinks it's in the best interest of its society. So I think the first truth I want to get across to people is this three P's of what it is government can do and should do in the lives of its citizens: prohibit, permit, or promote. And that's the foundation, I think, of the argument for traditional marriage. Because the second step I would take with people is perhaps the most controversial, but it isn't really if you sit and think about it. It's this idea that loving two biological parent households are an ideal. I think for most of us on either side of the aisle, and I was encouraged to see that David Blankenhorn from the Los Angeles Times opinion piece several years ago, actually in September of 2008, wrote a piece identifying himself as a very liberal Democrat on this issue, but siding against same-sex marriage because of the detriment it has for children. And I think his case was powerful. And I also think it's very reasonable for us to think about it for a second. I think it's impossible to deny the fact that children thrive best when raised by two loving biological parents in a low-conflict home. Even when compared with other low-conflict homes, when children are raised by their two biological parents, they do best in almost every single way we can measure. And I think there are other forms of family. For example, loving single-parent families, that's the way I was raised. Loving adoptive families. I have two daughters that I adopted. blended families, where two people are divorced and come together and bring their own children into the setting, and even same-sex families. All of these, I think, are other alternative forms of family, and they are certainly capable of raising great kids. But statistics continue to demonstrate what we already know intuitively, and I know this as a parent. While I think I'm doing a great job raising two daughters who I've adopted, it's clear to me they would be in a better situation if they still had their two biological parents in a loving, low-conflict relationship raising them. I think we can do a good job, but that situation would have been better. I think we're a good, close second place, but I still think it would have been better for my own daughters if they had been raised by their two biological parents in a loving, low-conflict setting. It's not possible for every child, is it? But where it is possible, we ought to promote it. We ought to see it as the ideal. First, the step, though, is going to be we have to see it as an ideal. Now, in 2002, a nonpartisan research group called Child Trends examined this, and this is what they basically said. And I think this is one of a very fair survey, a very fair research project, only because, first of all, it's from a nonpartisan group, and second of all, it wasn't targeting and comparing traditional marriage with same-sex marriage. It was simply looking at the issue of two biological parent households in a loving, low-conflict setting, and related to everything else, every other way you can measure. And what they came to the conclusion that, quote, family structure clearly matters for children, and the family structure that helps children the most is a family headed by two biological parents in a low-conflict marriage, unquote. See, it's not sexual orientation. That's not what defines a healthy environment for kids. It all comes down to whether or not children are being raised by their two biological parents who love each other and who love the biological child they made. So this is, I think, a very kind of intuitive sense. This is to make no statement against single parent families. I was raised in one of those. It's to make no pejorative statement against adoptive families or blended families or same-sex families. It's just to identify the singular truth that kids do best when raised by two loving, low-conflict biological parents. As a matter of fact, this is why I think that the United Nations has adopted this as a right for every child internationally. In the 1989 UNICEF document called the Convention on the Rights of the Child, in Article 7, guarantees children the right to be raised by their two biological parents whenever possible. This is seen as an international right for children to be raised by their two biological parents whenever possible. That's an internationally accepted human right. And I think that this is a place we can make a case then for our adopting the value in the promoting traditional marriage. Because I think the proponents of same-sex marriage would like us to frame the debate as a battle between those who affirm heterosexual relationships and those who affirm homosexual relationships. But that's not the battle. That's not a correct representation of what it is we're concerned about. Proponents of traditional marriage are not comparing sexual behaviors. They're comparing child-rearing environments. And studies repeatedly demonstrate the benefits of low-conflict two-biological parent households in the lives of kids when they're being raised. And this is now guaranteed as a human right by the United Nations. So that's my second step, is that we see an ideal. Now, a quick third step here. Government ought to promote the ideal. Proponents of traditional marriage, we favor a promotion of an ideal form of this family institution. But we recognize that all kinds of other forms of family ought to be permitted by government. When we're saying that a particular form of child-rearing family ought to be promoted, all the thing we're saying here is that there ought to be more of these rather than less. And we recognize the value that this form of family, the traditional form, has in creating well-balanced, thriving kids, even as we recognize the rights of children in this regard. So let me just give it to you, the three boxes of what should be prohibited, what should be promoted, and what should be permitted. I believe we ought to promote loving, low-conflict, two biological parent households. Those are the ideal family unit. And families of this kind have the best opportunity to raise thriving kids. And I think the government can promote this form of family in a number of ways, but at the very least, government can at least recognize these types of unions between people who may someday have a biological child of their own as marriages. That, if nothing else, by giving it that title, we recognize it as something unique and ideal that we want to promote. There's other things we can do, of course, but that's the least we could do. And in terms of permitting, I think government ought to permit all kinds of other forms of family, including low-conflict single-parent families, low-conflict adoptive households, low-conflict blended households, low-conflict same-sex households. Fine. There are many times, I think, that when two biological parents are simply unavailable to or unable to raise their kids. And government can permit this, but when it starts to call that marriage, same-sex unions, for example, marriage, now we're in the business of promoting it or saying it's equally as valid as the other form. And I think that's a mistake. I think this is where we would say, look, we're not against the kind of – you want to have that kind of a committed relationship with each other? Fine. We would permit that. And let me just say one thing. It might sound odd to you hearing a Christian say that you would be willing to permit this. Look, I have a definite view about what I consider to be sin and where I consider homosexuality to fall. But I am aware of the fact that if I want to convince my fellow countrymen of this issue, I can do it better by influencing them through reason than I can by legislating this on them. I want them to actually have a heartfelt rethink this, to think it again. And that can be done, I think, by us being careful about how we articulate the issue and being in dialogue here rather than trying to legislate this. One last thing. In terms of what it is we would say would government ought to prohibit, well, I think that clearly government ought to prohibit abusive, dangerous households of any kind. A loving single parent, adoptive, blended, or same-sex household, I would agree, is far better than a violent two biological parent household. But that's an unfair comparison. And I think that while low-conflict two-biological parent households are ideal, those who support traditional marriage like me, we all recognize that not all two-biological parent households are non-abusive. That's why we have laws. As a police officer, I've often had to enforce those laws that protect children from these types of relationships, these types of households. Look, it's true, I think, that honoring same-sex couples with the title of marriage, for some, they see this as an opportunity to, reduce homophobia or to reduce the kind of bias that many people have demonstrated toward homosexuals over the years. So they see this as, isn't that a good thing? And you silly Christians want to take that away. They see, I think, we would agree, though, as Christians, that nobody ought to be treated poorly based on his or her sexuality. We don't agree with that kind of treatment. And you might look at this and say the reduction of homophobia ought to be seen as a good thing. But think clearly for a minute. The recognition of the rights of children ought to be seen as a greater thing. I think a lot of people we talk to would like to characterize the debate over marriage as this battle between good and bad. But it's really a battle between good and greater. Our society's got to make a decision here, you know, between the benefits we might extend toward homosexuals and the rights we must recognize on the behalf of children. I think government is uniquely tasked to navigate this kind of moral dilemma. I think government can decide between two apparent goods, as it ultimately defends the rights of children as its primary obligation. And that's the reason why I think, along with a lot of other proponents of traditional marriage, that we ought to be advancing and promoting loving, low-conflict, two biological parent unions, and that's the form of family relationship that ought to be recognized as marriage. The title of marriage ought to be uniquely reserved for this promotional effort. That's why I think we can make a case, an articulate case, and a reasonable case to promote traditional marriage without ever really having to open our Bibles to do it. But I think in the end that there's three steps of demonstrating what it is that government can do with the three P's, of establishing loving two biological parent households as the ideal, and then being careful to argue why it is government ought to promote this ideal. Those are the three steps now I take when dealing with people on this issue. Now, look, you may have tried that as well and discovered that your friends and family have got significant pushback or have offered a challenge or an objection that was hard for you to navigate. If so, give me a call right here locally in the local footprint, 714-754-4150, or toll-free 1-800-227-5278. Let's talk about the kinds of responses you've gotten from people who, maybe didn't agree with this approach or had some variation of marriage they wanted to kind of throw at you in order to challenge you to see if your theory actually works. Let's talk about those today on our show, and I'm looking forward to talking to you more about that and all the other issues of ethics, values, and religion that you might be interested in today here on Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2 and the word reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2 and the word reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Back on Stand to Reason, I'm Jay Warner Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel, who is in Hungary today, and looking forward to taking your calls here at 1-800-227-5278. So get in line with us here, and I've got a chance to talk to Ian from Gainesville. Ian, I've enjoyed your conversations with Greg quite a bit over the last year or so, and so I'm looking forward to talking to you as well. How you doing, bud?
Well, thanks very much. I'm super. Thanks for asking. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad. I'm sorry that I know you called in early. Maybe you weren't expecting to get me instead of Greg, but I'm happy to take your call. So,
That's fine. I mean, a lot of why I call in is just to, as kind of like this ambassador. Like, I feel like I'm always talking past, or the religious folks are talking past the non-religious folks, and vice versa. And I want to not have that happen, so to open up better dialogue, and that's why I call in. So if you're here, that works too, because I also get an answer to my question.
Yeah, no problem. And I like you. I think you're right. I think a lot of times we do talk past each other, and I'm not sure if sometimes it's probably intentional, Ian. Maybe sometimes we get in a situation where the person we're talking to is uncomfortable, and or maybe it's just a matter of lack of connection where we don't understand each other's worldview well enough to kind of see where we're coming from. So we'll do our best to kind of try to talk to each other instead of past each other. How's that?
That sounds like a good plan.
Okay, cool.
And I think it actually has a lot to do with vocabulary.
Yes.
Greg had a biological scientist on a few weeks ago, and they were talking about the role of science and how science was inherently biased because it only looked for a naturalistic cause.
Right.
And they used a term, and it was naturalistic science, I think is how they described it. And I'm confused because to me, that's what science is. Like if it's not naturalistic, it's not science. And so I'm confused about when you think of science, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's usually when we talk about science, we're talking about one of two possibilities. We're talking about a philosophy we take in approaching any kind of an investigation or an examination, or we're talking about a certain methodology that we take. So what typically when I talk to people who haven't really thought about that, and I think you have thought about this in the distinction, that's why I think you were listening to Fuzz Rana, who was on with us a couple of weeks ago. And I think that for someone like you, you probably have already kind of thought through the distinctions. But a lot of people I talk to, when you talk about science, they kind of go back into their background in high school or where in college, wherever it was, if they weren't a science major, but they did take a class in some form of science. And they think of the scientific method, you know, that idea of observation and then hypothesis, prediction, experimentation, conclusion, this kind of steps you take, the five steps you might take in order to examine or run an experiment or test something, without thinking much about the philosophy you might take that might preclude certain types of answers altogether. And that's, I think, the problem for those of us who are theists, because typically we talk to people who would say, one of my reservations about being a theist is that it seems like there's just no way that I could examine this issue scientifically. And a lot of my friends who are still atheists would say, hey, you know, my problem is that I'm a scientific kind of person. You know, they'll kind of identify themselves as somebody who relies on science to a high degree. So the problem they're going to have is, I think if that's the case, if honestly, Ian, if you were interested as a non-theist, as an atheist, in looking at evidence and saying, hey, I gotta take a scientific approach to this examination of whether or not God exists, well, then I think we're going to have to alter the way you've been thinking about science to begin with. Because in order to examine the existence or the potential existence or even in any way likely existence of something that is extranatural, that is supernatural, that is outside the natural realm, we're going to have to open up our thinking on this to allow for at least the possibility of an extranatural or supernatural answer. If we begin from a perspective of complete scientific or complete philosophical naturalism, where we said, hey, the only things that count are those things that are from a natural environment, from a natural realm, then you've already excluded, right, the answer before you even begin. Now, I think I heard that little click, and I think we just lost Ian. So I know if I sit and talk long enough, we'll probably get Ian back. So be patient with us, and I'll just talk in Ian's absence for a minute. That's not, I know it wasn't our fault. It just happens occasionally. I hear it with Greg as well. So we'll just be patient here. But Ian, I think that's the rub for me, is that if we're going to say, hey, I've got to take a scientific approach, and I think I have you back, right? Don't I, Ian?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. If we're going to say, hey, I want to look at the issue of God's existence, but I am a scientific person who trusts and wants to take a scientific approach to this, then at least we're going to have to open up the doors slightly and allow for the possible answer, which you would preclude if you took a completely philosophical approach in the beginning that was entirely natural. So does that make sense? That's why I think for us to go forward and to even look at the issue of God's existence. Now I'm not somebody, Ian, who thinks that – I mean, I make cases in court all the time about events in the distant past for which I don't have any scientific evidence, and I can't run an experiment to determine whether or not this suspect is the best inference from the evidence. So I don't ever feel like I have to kind of be beholden to this scientific method but I have to at least leave in examining whether or not God did it. I have to at least leave open a path. Now I can close the path. It doesn't mean I'm previously committed to that path, but I have to leave the path open. Does that make sense?
No, that makes absolute sense. And so there's a definition of medicine, of alternative medicine, that I appreciate. Alternative medicine has either been proven not to work or not been proven to work. Because if it has been proven to work, they call it medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about a supernatural explanation that we have hello?
Go ahead. I'm still here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm still here, buddy. Yeah, go ahead.
If we have a supernatural explanation that we understand, that we mm-hmm. know the rules for, well, now it's a naturalistic explanation.
Right.
I get it. You know what it is. So I don't.
And I'll just tell you up front, my background, I don't know if we've ever talked about this before, but I came, you know, I was not, perhaps not as, and I'm not sure, did you say you had a biology background or a science background of some sort?
I do, and you were in cult cases and doing.
Right, and for me, I was an atheist until I was 35, and I'm still skeptical of my Christian brothers and sisters who will quickly run to a supernatural explanation for almost everything, when in fact I can see that there's another way to explain it, perhaps. So I'm still skeptical of that myself, if I'm honest with you. I'm probably the last person, I've learned in my profession to be the last person to be convinced that this guy did it. because I want to honor him, you know, and I want to drag my feet toward it so I don't just jump to conclusions. Because I've been wrong in the past, and I don't want to be wrong again, right? So now I'm very hesitant. I'm always the last guy on the team to be convinced, and my level's a lot higher. And I think I'm kind of still that way even now about supernatural things with my Christian brothers and sisters. But I do know that if they're... Unless we're willing to say we know with certainty up front, we don't even want to examine it, that there's nothing outside the natural order can exist, we're going to have to open up that door of possibility in our examinations, or we're precluding up front. That just, to me, makes no sense at all. We're saying, you know, that we're examining whether or not something supernatural, God, exists, but we're first saying that nothing supernatural can be a factor. We've kind of destroyed the path before we put our foot on it. And so for me, I think we have to at least leave that door open. But it also means, though, that if I come to a situation where I can explain this from a natural perspective, I have no hesitation in doing that. I'm looking for the best inference from the evidence. This is what I'm doing professionally. I'm always looking for the best inference from the evidence. And so this is what I think we're doing here too. But when we get to a place where, you know, all the evidence that is being offered by the naturalists, I think what a lot of my friends would say, what I would have said 15 years ago is, hey, you know what? Just because you can't explain it, that means you should wait. And right, because someday the scientist will have the answer. But as Christians, we often say, well, I don't have the answer, so someday I'll ask God and he'll have the answer. That's what we call that God of the gaps. This is just science of the gaps. I mean, there's no difference here. When we get a jury and panel a jury, we say, hey, given the evidence you have right now, you've got a choice. He's either guilty or not guilty. But you don't get the choice, we're going to wait. You have to make a decision given what evidence is in front of you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, right now. It may not be sufficient, and if that's the case, that's fine. But you don't get to say, well, you know, this makes no sense. Everything offered from a scientific perspective fails to answer this question. Therefore, we get to wait. Because I don't think that most of my atheist friends would afford me that same luxury as a theist. Does that make sense?
No, I understand that. Where I'm confused is, what constitutes like a natural explanation versus a supernatural explanation? Because now, if we can, if God exists in the universe, now that becomes as far as I'm understanding, is the word or the term. If God exists, then now it's part of a natural explanation. Or maybe I should a definition of science that I like is trying really, really hard not to be fooled. Doing all the things that I can to make sure that I'm not fooled.
Well, I don't think you and I disagree on that at all, Ian. I mean, I feel the exact same way.
Okay, so, and it's funny to me that we keep on, that Greg continually mentions the leprechaun analogy, because whenever I hear that, I'm like, well, I mean, there are these other explanations that don't require
Well, I'll give you an example of this. This is some of the things that I look at and I struggle with as somebody who tries to find an explanation. I do think it's difficult, if not impossible, for naturalists to give me an explanation of consciousness, an explanation of free will, an explanation of the origin of life, the origin of the universe that we actually could look at and would hold up to the same kind of scientific scrutiny they would require of other explanations. Even the existence of transcendent moral values. I mean, these are things that I honestly do not think there is a good. And here's the other thing about this too, Ian. It's not as though for me, it's just that I have this one area that I don't think that naturalists or that atheists have a good explanation for. I think there are entire sets of classes of problems that atheists don't have a good answer for that are from a number of different disciplines. They aren't all in the same category even. So when I look at these pieces of evidence that are in this room called the universe and I ask myself what best explains these pieces of evidence that I see, I'm always trying to infer to the best explanation. And I don't think there is much work being done in many of these fields scientifically, honestly, because the origin of life, for example, I think not a lot of work is being done right now in that field. Because there's not a lot that is being successful. I think most scientists who work in this area would admit their own frustration about this particular dilemma. Now, of course, a lot of my friends would say, well, just wait. You know, we didn't know anything about this other thing, and now you just gotta wait. But again, I come back to that analogy of the jury. Fine. But in this lifetime, the one that I'm living, I have to make decisions. Decisions about what I believe that are gonna have an impact on how I live.
Yep.
And I don't get the luxury of saying, well, that answer may not be available until two generations from now. So I'll suspend a decision. I have no problem, actually, with you making a decision on the basis of the evidence that you see, which is actually the opposite of mine. But I think all of us are called to make that decision now. And I think when we get to places where our particular worldview simply has no satisfactory answer, it ought to cause us to want to scratch that itch a little bit. It ought to cause us to want to look at that. Like you said, you don't want to be fooled. But don't think for a second that when you get to a place where you don't have an answer that's offered by the worldview that you hold, that you aren't being fooled. Because, of course, that is exactly what's happening. When our worldview cannot provide us with a satisfactory answer, we might start to wonder if, in fact, we're being fooled. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to look and say, hey, I just don't see it's not as though I'm a Christian because I think, you know, God did it is the best answer. It answers all my dilemmas. A lot of why I'm a Christian is because I look at the answers offered by the atheist position, and they're just wholly unsatisfactory. So I've got no – I mean, that's where I'm going to land. That's in a position where I have no answers for a lot of stuff that I need answers for. And I'm being told, hey, just wait. Someday you might have it.
Are they, the answers that you receive, are they unsatisfactory because, you know, you intuit an answer and the information that you're getting doesn't match up with that? Or is it because they fail on their merits to propose, like, to further their argument?
Well, I could give you an example of this. For a lot of this stuff, you know, I'm not an expert in origin of life sciences, okay, that would bring
okay.
So, but when I listened to the atheists who are, they're telling me how unsatisfied they are with the answers. So it's not as though I get to a place and I say, yeah, you got a good answer, but I'm unsatisfied with it. No, I'm actually at a place where I look at the answers that they provide, and I'm listening to them say, we're stumped, and we're not satisfied with the answers. And that really is the case for a lot of these areas I'm describing. And I remember just, you know, I'm not somebody who my master's degree is in architecture and in theology, okay? But I don't have a master's degree in philosophy. That's where Greg is such an asset to our community. But I can tell you that, you know, I also took a long course on the problem of mind because I wanted to know what were the answers being offered from the scientific community about the problem of consciousness. And it's not that I'm unsatisfied with some good answers they provide. It's that they're not satisfied with any of the answers they provide. So I think that's why I look at that kind of stuff and I say, hey, if I'm a betting man and I'm trying to get to the most reasonable inference from the evidence in front of me, I'm more inclined to hold this position as a theist for that reason, as I still think it's the best explanation of the evidence. That's where I'm coming from. So I just want you to know I'm not sure that's a satisfying answer for you, but that's my approach to it.
I guess I'm going to have to, it's frustrating to me because I feel as though the answers are there. You're talking about the problem of mind, emergent properties works for me. You're talking about the problem of morality and moral philosophy. I think Wittgenstein's language theory kind of covers that pretty well. You want to talk about the origin of life or the origin of the universe. Well, okay, that's still a question, but all the things that come after that, we've got a pretty good understanding of.
Well, if nothing else, okay, we only have about a minute here before the break, Ian, but
sure.
I think I can respect what you're saying. You've got some theories that have been put in place that you think are satisfying. Okay, great. But let me ask you a question. If the theories you have which are satisfying are Greg always uses this as an analogy, and I think it's a great analogy. These are the plays in the game that work for you. A running play here, a passing play there, you know, a field goal will get you where you want to go. But the problem you're having is you've got no way to explain the kickoff of any of this game. Is that your system requires a way to start before we can even ask the question, does step five work for me? If step one won't get you in the game, if it won't get the entire system started, then all kinds of theories about what happens afterwards, to me, don't work for me. I need an explanation which doesn't just cover the third and fourth play of the series. I need an explanation that gets this game started. I need something foundational that I can say, hey, because this foundation is so clear and so solid, we can now step off and play the game. But what I'm seeing from that perspective is that there's no kickoff at all. There's no way to start this game that we're trying to offer the fourth and fifth play on. And so for me, that's really where I'm coming from. I think that one of the biggest foundational problems you're going to have in this worldview that you hold is how we begin to the most important questions that worldview answers, Ian. How did we get here? How did it all get so messed up, and how do we fix it? These are the three questions that all of us, regardless of our worldview, have to answer. And the answer to that first question, how did we get here, is really the beginning of answering the second two questions. You can't even answer the second two questions until you first have an answer to the first question. And until I've got a satisfactory answer to the first question, I think any worldview is deficient that can't satisfactorily answer the first question. And so that's why I think that origin of the universe and origin of life questions are foundational to this worldview called atheism, and they have to be mined. There's no reason for me to even look for the second two answers until I know that the first answer is solid. Now, look, we're up against a break, and as I know, I'm sure you're going to call in with Greg in the future, and maybe even with me as I'm sitting here hosting the show. So, you know, I really appreciate you giving me time to pontificate here about these issues. I appreciate you calling, bud.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate that as well.
Thank you, sir.
Take care, sir.
Okay, so that's kind of the end of our first segment here. We're going to go to a break, and when we get back, we'll talk a little bit more. We've got some people on the line. Joshua from Illinois, looking forward to talking to you about whether or not abortion is murder. Right back here on Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ, and that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim Mission. This is a 4-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
Yes, we continue to do all of our bumper music from Doug Powell, who was our guest here a couple of weeks ago. And get to see him, I think, in 2 weeks. And or maybe it's next week. You know what? Whatever week it is, in Phoenix for the Smart Faith Conference. Looking forward to that. Looking forward to hanging out with Doug. In the meantime, we're making him famous with all the bumper music. Here we are, right back at Stand to Reason. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg. Taking a stand for the things that matter most in life. And let's face it, the right to life is a big issue that matters most in life. Can't have something that matters most if we don't have life to begin with. So let's talk about that and answer this question from Joshua, calling from Illinois. Joshua, you want to ask a question about abortion? I'm happy to take your call.
Yes, thank you, Jay Warner, for taking my call.
Of course.
I just want to state clearly ahead of time that I agree that abortion is murder.
Mm-hmm.
So this is mostly a curiosity question as to the ethics of it.
Yes.
If abortion is objectively murder,
okay,
then if the legislation was to change in this country to where the government then decides that, yes, abortion is murder, would then everybody who committed or had an abortion prior to that, should they be tried for murder?
Well, I think, first of all, that's an illegal issue that's very different than the moral issue which is incumbent upon it now. If we decide, and we've got good philosophical reason to decide, that the fetal human, that the destroying a fetal human is exactly the same ethically as destroying a baby who's born a week after it's born or a year or 10 years, then the issue about whether or not this is murder is another issue altogether about whether what we would do legally with those who have committed a crime. Now, typically, I can tell you this happens all the time in the state of California. We have something called the California Penal Code. And here, this changes a lot. It changes all the time. As a matter of fact, what changes more than anything else are the penalties that are just recently, as a matter of fact, in our state, they changed a number of penalties because of the overcrowding in the state prisons. And they decided they wanted to reduce the number of people in state prison. So what they decided to do was to make many crimes that used to have longer sentences have much shorter sentences. And, of course, if you are arrested today under today's version of that code, you will not serve – either some things aren't even have been decriminalized altogether. And other things – so, for example, where it used to be a petty theft was anything under $400. It's recently been changed to $950. So if you now steal something that's worth $600, it's the penalty is much different. And so I would say that when we change laws in this fashion, we don't go back and retroactively – you can't arrest people retroactively for that kind of behavior. As a matter of fact, I'll give you an example of this, Josh. In California, when we do cold cases, if I'm doing a case in which it occurred, let's say, in 1980, and we are looking to sentence the convicted murderer of a 1980 crime in the year 2012, we don't use the 2012 sentencing guidelines. We have to use the sentencing guidelines that were available and that were dictated back in 1980. So if now this would have been a life sentence for committing this murder, but in 1980 you'd have gotten 10 years for it, guess what you're going to get for it? You're going to get 10 years because the laws apply to you and the era in which you committed the crime. Not we don't retroactively apply laws. So I think that because of that, I would have no problem with us going forward and looking at every future. Also, I think that's fair, Joshua, in another sense. When I commit a crime, I commit it typically knowing what the penalty will be for the commission of this crime. And that penalty either acts as a deterrent or not. But it's fair to tell people that when they commit the crime in the era in which they committed it, the law that was present to them when they thought about whether they should commit the crime, that's the law that should be applied to them rather than some other era's law. Does that make sense? So I think I would say no, I wouldn't go back and change it for those who committed this crime or this act in the years before it was even determined to be against the law, but you would just go from this point forward so that a person who's deciding, should I do this today, would think about what the penalty is for this today. And that makes more sense to me. If it does to you, I don't know.
Okay. Let me just try one more thing with you.
Okay.
Nazi Germany, it was completely appropriate to murder Jews and gypsies and all sorts of socially undesirable persons. Now, there were war tribunals that sentenced a lot of those persons who underwent those murders or committed those murders and punished them for actions that for their era and for their government was completely legitimate. So on a moral from a moral standpoint, we determined that that was murder and wrong, mm-hmm. and we punished people accordingly. Is that somehow different than if we change laws within our own government?
Yes, because I think what we're seeing here, and the person who did that was one of the very few people who went out of this kind of a position he was in, working as a United States Attorney General for a season. He later became an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. His name is Robert Jackson. He's the person who actually tried the Nuremberg trials of these war criminals. And the question there was that there are lots of places in the world where, and even in Germany, where this type of murder, this type of crime, this type of killing was considered to be murder. And so the question, and this is exactly the defense that was offered by these war criminals, this defense you just offered, that, hey, in the culture in which we grew, in the culture in which we worked, this was not seen as a crime. This was seen as something virtuous. This is how we promoted from one rank to the other. This is how we got ahead in our organizations. This was seen as something that was good to do. Who are you to come over and impose your laws outside of Germany on those of us who live inside of Germany? And so I think there is a factor here of it's not as though there were no laws set for this, and now suddenly there were. All the nations that rallied together who surrounded this country considered this to be illegal. And the question, of course, was simply, is this truly illegal the way that we've already established it in our country, or is it not? Now, what Jackson said was that there was not just the law on your land and the law on our land, that there was actually a law above the law. And that's probably the biggest, most famous quote from Robert Jackson on this issue. And I do believe that there is a law above the law. But when it comes, this is what the whole trial is about, is are there certain international laws in place that would allow us retroactively to go and do this? Those laws, by the way, Joshua, were in place before the Nuremberg trials. And so we're simply saying, at that point, they were simply saying, do these international laws about war crimes apply to these folks? It's not like we're creating these laws for these folks. These laws are already in place, and do they righteously and justifiably apply to these criminals? That's a little bit different, I think, than the scenario you gave me, which we're saying, hey, we didn't have a law about this at all, and now we're going to create one. So should we go back in hindsight? And so does that help you kind of think through that issue at all?
I guess my only issue is, where does the authority for this law above the law come from? And if it's from objective morality mm-hmm. that is generally accepted, how is that different than us determining that abortion is objectively wrong and these people are committing a crime against this law or this, yeah, law above laws?
Well, I think for us to be able to say that first of all, when you commit a crime like this, there's certain levels of who it is you've offended, right? If you live in the state of California and do certain crimes, you've certainly offended the citizenry in California. We have laws in the state California Penal Code that deal with how you – so, for example, you commit a bank robbery in California. You have broken several laws. You've broken the law of the state of California related to robbery. You've also broken the law on the federal level – because that money in that bank is FDIC insured, right? It's insured by at a federal level. So you've also broken a federal law. You can be tried at the state level or tried at the federal level. But we would say as Christians, you've also broken the law of the creator of the universe. Now, what we're trying to determine here is, you know, who should do the punishing? Often if we take somebody to jail for a robbery at the state level, we're not going to try them at the federal level. But in the end, the creator of the universe adjudicates all the crimes we've committed. So I'm not typically too concerned. Oh, gosh, you know, I'm upset because those who have committed this horrific objective crime of murder because they committed abortions back when abortion was legal, now they seem like they're gonna get away with it. We've made it illegal, but they, you know, they don't fall under this time period of time. So look, one thing for sure, Joshua, the God who created us still sits in judgment of all the things that we do. So in the end, I do believe that it's the fact that some of these crimes won't be punished in this life is one of those things that kind of gives me an inclination that there is a God who will judge these things in the next life. And so I think this is, for me, I'm looking at the ways in which we say, who have you offended? You've offended the state, the federal government, but more importantly, you've offended the holy God who created you, whose laws we simply parrot at the federal and state level. And so I'm willing to allow that judgment that we can be of the legal authority to execute here at the state level, that we have the legal authority to implement at the federal level. But I'm certainly I'm trusting that God will do what He has to do and what He needs to do in the realm of heaven or hell. So I think that I'm not too concerned about I've allowed God that authority to be able to do what I may not be able to do in this life. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess then, I mean, maybe not even a question, it's whether we should want our governments now to be enacting punishments and such that are at God, you know, are equal to the law above all laws sort of thing. But then again, I guess that goes along with, you know, you can't have ex post facto laws going around. Like you said, in the state of California, you can't retroactively apply laws to people.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense for a couple of philosophical reasons, most importantly of which is that when you do something that you know is wrong to do, you want to know what the natural consequences. If I do this, if I take this, my mom's going to spank me. You know, if I take this, I'm going to get a timeout. If I'm just going to take my cell phone. I mean, my kids know what the consequences are of their actions in the household in which they live. So I think that's fair. That you make a decision knowing what the punishment will be. You don't worry about what the punishment might be if the law changes in 5 years. You have to deal with the punishment that exists today. Now, I'm like you. I do believe that in the end, we aren't in the kingdom of heaven. And there's lots that's been written about this, and maybe we'll talk to Melinda over the break, and we'll see if there's anything on STR's site that we can point you to that will help you kind of distinguish between the world in which we live and the kingdom of heaven in which God will judge over all of us. And these two kingdoms are it's a struggle, I think, for many of us to kind of see where should the hard lines be drawn between these two kingdoms. And if I can find a resource, I'll point you to it here on Twitter or through Melinda here at str.org, okay, if that helps you a little bit. So
that would be awesome.
So now the quick question for you, though, as you're calling me from it sounded like your position wasn't clear. Are you a Christian who's or are you an atheist who's thinking about this? What's your stand in terms of your spiritual?
Christian. I believe that abortion is objectively wrong. Okay. I was just curious from a, just in case the question ever comes up sort of thing. And it is something that I couldn't answer myself. So,
yeah, let me just point you to the work that Robert Jackson did in that Nuremberg trial. I think it's a great illustration for us of how international. Again, he's kind of looking at it the same way. You have a law in Germany. There's an international law that's been violated, and there's the law above the law that's been violated. Clearly, he's not there trying to implement the law above the law. He's saying you've broken the international laws, that we're in this international forum in which you're now going to be judged as a war criminal. So it wasn't as though he didn't have laws that he could enforce. But again, he's not stepping up and saying he's enforcing God's laws, although I'm sure the international law were reflective of God's laws. Hey, I hope that helps you a little bit as you think through this, Joshua. I appreciate your phone call. Okay, we are now screaming up on the end of the first hour. Had a great time talking to you. Next hour, we're joined by the American Family Radio Network. Looking forward to that. We'll be talking a little bit about events with Dan Savage's recent comments and getting your phone calls right here. Stand to Reason. Sitting in for Greg Kokel. He's usually here every Sunday, and now we're in the 3 to 5 period of time, which is when American Family Radio Network is to join us, and so I'm glad to have you on board. Here we are talking about ethics, values, and religion, and contending for the Christian worldview. And Greg is this week in Hungary, where he's in, part of an amazing, it sounds like so far an amazing conference that training up Christians to defend what they believe, and I just know he's going to have tons of stories to tell us when he gets back, so I'm looking forward to hearing those. And in his absence, I will do my best to answer your phone calls here at 1-800-227-5278. And if you're local here in Southern California, 714-754-4150. My good buddy Jonathan Morrow will be here next hour to talk about a book that he's written, which I think is an important book called Think Christianly. And I think that even more important than – well, I don't say more important, but we're at the end of a season, and everyone's getting ready to graduate, and I'm hearing so many stories about young people getting ready to graduate high school and go to college, and here we've got a guy who's also written a good book that'll prepare young people for college called Welcome to College, and so we'll maybe get a few seconds to talk about that as well, but his book, Think Christianly, I think is a must-read for anybody who's wants to focus in on the importance of developing a solid Christian worldview and seeing how that solid Christian worldview will actually impact the way you think and act in the world today. So looking forward to talking to him next hour. But this hour, we get a chance to talk, so once again, give me a call, 1-800-227-5278. Let me just open up this hour with something a couple of weeks ago I almost had a chance to talk about, just didn't quite fit it into the show. Because at that point, it wasn't maybe a week before that, that Dan Savage, who is kind of made a name for himself as an anti-bullying activist, he actually went out and did a keynote address. It was on April 13th, actually. It was the National High School Journalism Conference that was sponsored by National Scholastic Press Association. And he went out and made a few statements that got a lot of national press. In essence, he made some statements which were kind of perceived as bullying statements. against some of the Christians, non-Christian men and women who were in the audience, many of whom got up and left during Dan Savage's talk. And instead of kind of going into all the drama around, there's enough's been said about that, I really want to address a couple of the objections that Dan Savage raised in his, and you can go online and Google this on YouTube. You can watch the entire set of comments. They were filmed by somebody with a camera phone. The phone camera, rather, and did a great job of capturing what he said. So I won't go into all of that. But I will say that he made two large claims that on their face, I do think I see a lot of us as Christians, we struggle in being able to adequately respond to the two big objections that Dan offered as part of his talk. And so let me just kind of address these large objections and try to give you a strategy for just kind of responding to the kinds of objections that he made. The first category he made were this idea that, hey, you know, you Christians, you pick and choose what you will follow from the Old Testament. And he used a lot of strong language. I won't repeat that strong language, but he said, hey, you guys, you know, you look at lots of stuff and you determine that it's baloney. I didn't use the word baloney, but you determine this is baloney and you ignore it. For example, you ignore what it says about disobedient children in Leviticus 20, verse 9. You know, if there's anyone who curses his father or his mother, he shall surely be put to death. You don't put to death disobedient children. And you also ignore the passage in Deuteronomy 22 about daughters who are not virgins when they marry, where it says they ought to be stoned by the elders of the city at the gate. You know, it's, you don't stone your daughters if they're not virgins when they marry. So there's a lot of baloney that you Christians choose to ignore. Well, now, Christians, it's time for you to ignore the baloney that's in Leviticus 18:22 that says that you shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It's an abomination. So as a homosexual male, a man who's talking to this group, he basically said, hey, there's a lot of baloney you just willy-nilly choose to ignore in the Old Testament, yet you seem to be hung up on this issue of homosexuality. Now it is time for you to put it in the same category as all the other stupid baloney that you people seem to be okay ignoring. So we have to, I think, be ready to offer a response on this. And the other issue he raised was the issue of slavery, which I'll get to in a minute. But I think if I was there and I had a chance to respond to him afterwards, what I simply would have said to him at the time would have been that, look, I do agree that there are absolutely some things in the Levitical law, some things in the Old Testament that I choose to ignore. But it's not willy-nilly. It's not random personal preference. I'm not choosing to embrace some aspects of the Bible while rejecting other parts depending on my personal preference. Instead, I ignore aspects of the Levitical law specifically. Let me tell you what I ignore. I ignore those aspects of the Levitical law which deal with local, time-sensitive issues that were specific to the nation of Israel where and when they were living. Of course we do that. These are the parts of the law that were given to this group at this time for this purpose. As a Christian, we already know we do this because do any of us obey the laws related to sacrifices? Of course we don't. We know that that was given to them and it was wholly replaced by what Jesus did on the cross for us. So yes, there are some, but it's not willy-nilly. It's not my personal preference. It's because I understand that those laws were given for those people at that time. But secondly, I ignore all penalty aspects of the law. All penalty aspects. So whatever it may say in the Old Testament, if this is violated, here's the penalty. I ignore this because this too, I believe, is time and place and people specific. Let me just give you an example of why I believe this to be the case. And I told this story on my own podcast, and I've told it, I think, here on Stand to Reason as well. But let me just offer it again. I can remember as a child being in a store in which the kid going in front of the counter before me shoplifted something from the rack right next to the counter. And my mom and I, who were in line watching this, we watched it occur, and I just didn't see her say anything about it, so I also grabbed an item that I intended to walk out with. And sure enough, as I did that, my mom stopped and did what I think probably every good Italian mom did in 1969 or 68 or 67, and she slapped me in the face in front of everybody. It shamed me. It was so quick, no warning. She just smacked me. And I thought to myself, you know, I didn't say much because you don't say much when your mom's that angry at you, but But eventually it was like, hey, this kid in front of us just – and she basically gave me this little routine, which you maybe said to your own kids or heard from your own parents. That's fine if he does that. He doesn't belong to us. He's not a Wallace. You belong to me. I taught you better than that. And if I ever catch you doing that again, it would be worse. Don't ever let me catch you doing that again. And I was struck by how the standard for me being in her family was so dramatically higher than the standard for the other kid who she just let get away with it. That's because, of course, she was loving and protecting me and wanting me to be different than the people who were around me. And this, of course, is what God is doing in Old Testament law as well. Dramatic, boot camp-like restrictions on the nation of Israel in its formation, in its most formative years. You see the nation of Israel always described as a child. And the history of Israel is I think they are expected to learn from their youth that they will then retain something for their middle age. And the youth of the nation of Israel is clearly getting a boot camp version of the law and the punishments that are offered because they are being commanded. It's God who loves them, has created them. They know better. And, of course, the punishments are much higher. So I do reject certain things but it's not because they're just personal preference. I recognize that both the level of punishment and the laws specific to certain things that only existed in that culture at that time were not intended for me. But there is also something that I embrace in its totality. And I don't choose to ignore. There are certain things that I absolutely do choose to embrace, and I accept them from the Old Testament law related to Israel. And once again, it's not willy-nilly. It's not randomly based on my personal preference. I accept that the things that God says offend him do truly offend him, even now. The moral aspect of that law I do embrace, and while the penalties can be established by each culture through history, and they certainly have, the misbehaviors are still the same, and they offend God. It's still offensive to disrespect and curse your parents. It's extremely offensive to God. It's not that homosexuality is no big deal to God, and that he doesn't see it as anything worse than cursing your parents. It's that the kind of disrespect that the law is describing toward your parents is every bit as offensive as homosexuality. And yes, we may even have similar punishments for some crimes today. It's true. We do have some similar penalties. But this says nothing about our respect for biblical law. It simply reflects our values at this time and place in history. So that's my response to Dan's first objection, the objection that we seem to be able to ignore certain things. Now it's time to ignore this as well. Well, the one thing I don't ignore is how this behavior is perceived by God. And I'm consistent about that. And I'm consistent about what I do ignore. And it's not based on my personal preference. One thing that Dan also said was he said, you know, the Bible gets slavery all wrong. That you Christians, and he quoted Sam Harris in this, in the one most important issue of the time, slavery, is the one issue that the Bible consistently gets wrong. It advocates for slavery. Paul says nothing to stop slavery. He simply gives you a guideline for how to work within the system of slavery. So Dan Savage says, this book you have that you seem to be trusting for a moral barometer to be able to kind of direct you in moral issues gets the most important issue of morality wrong. How can you trust it to tell you anything about homosexuality? But, of course, this does what almost every argument related to slavery does, is it mistakes the nature of slavery. Because when you say the word slavery, what do you think of? You think of what we would call New World slavery, what I've always called New World slavery. This idea that the kind of slavery that occurred here in the Americas, for example, is in any way similar to New Testament slavery, and we've got to be able to compare those two things, New Testament slavery with New World slavery. What Dan's been able to do is to rhetorically slip one in for the other, and then he says, you see how offensive this is. But there are many differences between New Testament slavery and New World slavery. Now, I've written an article on this in our Hot Topics section at Please Convince Me, and I know that Greg's also got stuff that the Millennium can point you to. But I'm going to tell you, it's really hard to go through all the verses, and I won't bore you with all the verses, but I see several key differences. First of all, I see there's a huge difference in the motive behind slavery. You need to understand why slavery existed in each case to begin with, both in New Testament slavery and in New World slavery. Here in America, the New World slaves, they were taken so that their masters could have a better life for economic gain. But in the ancient world, the primary motive for slavery was the economic relief of the servant himself. And so you have to look at what motivates people. Often placed themselves in slavery to relieve an economic debt. So if you look at the difference between New World slavery and New Testament, so you could start by saying there's a huge difference in motive. But more importantly, how people entered into slavery is very different. In the American version of kind of New World slavery we think of in our history, people were taken into captivity and slavery against their will. They were simply kidnapped or were later born into captivity from parents that were taken in captive. But in the ancient New Testament version of slavery, the path into slavery was it's varied, and it was in many cases voluntary. There are several types of ways that servants or slaves of the New and Old Testament entered into this indentured servitude. First, there were voluntary, temporary, indentured Hebrew servants that entered into this. They needed assistance. They simply couldn't pay their debt. They would either turn to some form of voluntary indentured servitude to get by. And the Bible had guidelines for this kind of voluntary servitude. And if you read those guidelines out of the Old Testament, you'll see how, especially when compared to neighboring nations, the biblical guidelines for indentured voluntary servitude were incredibly ethical. And then you also had voluntary permanent Hebrew servants. It wasn't uncommon for a temporary indentured servant to want to stay in the service of his or her master. You know, they weren't treated harshly in the way that New World slaves are thought of. Instead, they were often treated so well and so much like family that they wanted to stay with their families even once the debt was paid. And so there was a number of biblical guidelines in the Old Testament for the treatment of these kinds of servants who became part of your family. But there's a third way. Involuntary Hebrew and Gentile criminals that are in restitution. In other words, we often will have a murder case that'll work in which somebody will be convicted and they'll serve a certain sentence. And they're also ordered to pay a restitution to the victim's family. It's usually not discussed much. Most times the press is more interested on how many years the guy will serve and not is he ever going to have to pay any type of restitution to a family. But there were several crimes in the New Testament times and Old Testament times that required restitution as a part of the penalty following a conviction. And if the criminal was unable to make the restitution, they ended up many times convicted. People found themselves in servitude as servants, paying off the debt they owed to society, the debt they owed to God. And there are many guidelines for how these types of indentured servants were treated. Now, definitely there were some permanent, what we would call pagan servants. The ancient Hebrews did have permanent slaves they obtained from non-Jewish nations that surrounded them. They were basically conquests of war victories, and they came into their possession that way. And there were a certain set of ethical treatment, ethical guidelines. But remember that even during all of this, the scripture prevented Jews, for example, from kidnapping even a pagan man against his will to hold or to sell him. And unlike New World slavery, where slaves entered into slavery involuntarily, the ancient New Testament version of slavery and of indentured servitude was far more varied, far more voluntary. In fact, we don't know when you read in Scripture about a specific slave being addressed, it's difficult to know how that person actually came into the service of their master. And in many ways, especially based on all the voluntary ways you might be brought into that type of relationship, it's more of a work relationship than it is of a slave-owner relationship. But here's what more clearly. How people were treated once they were slaves, to me, is the big deal. Is there a similarity here? And really, it's a great difference between the way that slaves were treated in the New World and how they were treated in the ancient Near East. And I think we're all familiar with these kind of stories from Americana, from our history, chronicling that kind of harsh and many times brutal mistreatment of slaves. But they were considered, in this setting, they were considered the lowest forms of property and not even considered human in many cases, and they were treated as though they were not human in many cases. But in the ancient New Testament version of servitude, that's another story altogether. Slaves were treated humanely, and their treatment was actually regulated by biblical law. Just a few of the kind of legal requirements I see as I scan through Old Testament scripture are that, first of all, slaves are not to be treated harshly. They're to be treated humanely with respect. That slaves were allowed to make a decision about whether or not they would even stay with their masters. That slaves were often released, and when it was done, the slave was to be released with the possessions they came with. And slaves were allowed religious privileges while they're in the working for somebody. They were allowed to rest on the Sabbath along with everyone else. They were allowed to celebrate religious holidays and other religious celebrations. And the masters had to be held accountable for the way they treated their slaves. And I'm going to tell you, a lot is made of the way that slaves are punished in Old Testament. But even though it's pretty clear that the Old Testament law did allow for the punishment of slaves, but the punishment of slaves was exactly the same as that was prescribed for non-slaves, or and even for the sons of non-slaves. So it's not as though there was a different standard of punishment for slaves than there were for anybody else who would commit the same crime. Slaves could actually be freed if they were not treated properly by their masters. And foreign slaves were prescribed refuge under biblical law. They were not treated as property. They could actually be brought into the Jewish covenant and become Jewish believers alongside their masters. They had rights within the homes of their masters. And as a part of the family, they could even share in the inheritance. So if you look at how I don't think it's fair for Dan Savage or anybody else to compare, to throw the word slave into the audience's ears, knowing that they are going to hear it as the New World Version, when in fact that's not what we're describing in Scripture at all. It's a New Testament version, and that's a very different type of indentured servitude. Even the way that people were actually able to free themselves from slavery in the New Testament, a family member could purchase your freedom by simply paying your debt. A slave could purchase his own freedom by simply paying his debt. Slaves were freed as part of the National Day of Debt Forgiveness on every seventh year anyway. And an injury to a slave would often be a means by which the slave could gain his or her freedom by simply petitioning for it based on how they were treated. To compare these two ideas, the idea of New World slavery to the idea of New Testament slavery, is simply unfair. And when American slave owners used the Bible to support their ownership, they clearly were either ignorant of the true nature of slaves in ancient times, or were willingly and willfully denying the truth about New Testament slavery. And I think those slave owners may have tried to use the Bible to support their position, but by doing so, they clearly twisted the intent and the meaning of the Scriptures. And they were applying guidelines for one form of servitude to an entirely different form of slavery. It's unfair to say that the God of the Bible supports the institution of slavery that existed in the New World. That version of slavery has little in common with the version of servitude that existed in biblical times. And this is what Dan does, is he simply tries to analogize one to the other. And you may get this said to you as well. I mean, he's actually quoting Sam Harris, who made the case in, I think it was, Letter to a Christian Nation, where he first made this case. So when you hear this argument that your Bible gets the idea of slavery wrong, let's be sure about defining our terms and ask people the important question. What do you mean by slavery? Do you mean the kind of slavery we see in the New World, or the kind of slavery that existed in New Testament times? There is a huge difference between those two, and it's important for us to keep the difference in our minds. All right, so I hope those two ideas, two techniques at least, will kind of give you some comfort, and also to help you make the case when people challenge you in this area. There's stuff online in our Hot Topics section at Please Convince Me. I'll try to tweet that here during the break. And we'll take a short break and come back to your phone calls. 1-800-227-5278, locally 714-754-4150. We got somebody on the line right now, but we've got room for your call, so give us a call right here at Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800, the number 2, and the word Reason today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800, the number 2, and the word Reason to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Here on Stand to Reason, Jay Warren Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel, trying to look at life right side up, which I'm hoping to do with you today. Give me a call, 1-800-227-5278. I'll squeeze you in here before we end this hour. Next hour, we've got Jonathan Morrow speaking about Think Christianly. I think an important book that I'd like to help you get in your hands, because it's one of those books that, especially this time of year, is important to give to young people. And of course, Jonathan's working with young people all the time, so maybe that's why he's always got that audience in mind. Let's go to Jared in Sacramento and talk about what topic is important to youth ministry. How are you, Jared?
I'm doing great, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
I'm glad to do it.
I just talked to my head pastor today, and he I've been talking with him for about a year and a half, and he just gave me the reins, essentially, to our youth group. Mm-hmm. And I've been listening to you and Brett and Greg and guys like J.P. Moreland and whatnot, and I'm just kind of curious, what is a good topic or set of topics to lay a good foundation for, you know, Christian worldview building for kids coming from a variety of backgrounds? You know, some of them are coming from moderate Christian backgrounds. Some of them are coming from, you know, non-religious backgrounds. So or just, you know, because you have such a, in my opinion, successful youth ministry, what kind of place should I be starting in?
Yeah, that's always the trick, right? The trick is, if we decide that apologetics are important to young people, then the question is always, well, do you have some resources that I mean, what resources should I start with? Do you have like a series, like, you know, what topic should I teach on? I get those kinds of questions a lot. And I think right. It all comes down to some of the worldview issues we talked about with Ian last hour, that all worldview is built on these three questions. The question of how do we get here? How did it get so messed up? And how do we fix it? And a lot of the youth groups that I've seen kind of emerge in the last 10 years are really more interested in how do I fix this mess. They're mostly socially active. They want to get involved in social justice, those kinds of issues. But you and I have a great opportunity to help young people be convinced and firm about the answers to their first question. How did all this stuff appear? How did we get here? Because, again, that's the question that has to be answered before we can even begin to answer the next two questions. So I would be inclined – and the first series I think I did in apologetics with my own kids, well, you know, I'm trying to think. I think the first one, I might have sensed in my own youth group years ago that the biggest dilemma I had, Jared, was that young people were being attacked, challenged in their setting, and they needed answers. And so the question was, I need answers quickly. So the first series I actually did with my youth group was answering the objections of atheists on certain key areas. And I realized, of course, right away that I needed to give my kids a firm foundation in the arguments for the existence of God, right? So that was the very next series I did. But because I felt a certain sense of urgency and wanting to be able to give them tools to answer these objections, the first series I did was, I forget the name I did. I mean, I tried to be creative about how I approached this, because I had a very big group that was, at the time, our church had not really divided junior high and high school yet. And so I would have, and it's the same room I'm teaching this, I'm trying to teach it really at kind of a college level for my high school seniors to get them ready to go to college, right? I also had seventh graders, so that's pretty tough. So I tried to find a way to make this as entertaining as I could without giving up the first and most important primary thing to me, which is content. So I wanted to push my kids as hard as I can, but I know that we can be as high school leaders, as youth leaders, we can be wooed and caught up in the entertainment aspect of our ministries. But I don't think that by moving toward content, we have to give up on engaging in a way that's passionate, in a way that isn't even entertaining. So I think you can, for example, teach the cosmological argument in a way that is engaging with media that is, it's not a yawn. It's actually, wow, really? That's great. And that's what I want my kids to come out of the room at the end of it and go, wow, that was really cool. At the same time, I want to give them the tools and the arguments they need, but I don't want to lose the cool factor, because I think I know for my own young people, they are so motivated by media that everything they consume, I'll give you an example of this. You may see that Brett does a podcast here called Bulletproof, right? And this podcast is great, but it's not geared toward young people. He works with young people, but his podcast is not geared toward young people. He's doing a podcast that clearly his audience are the parents of young people. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, here's our guy, right? Our guy at Stand to Reason who does things for young people, and he's got a podcast. If the podcast doesn't seem to address young people, what's the deal with that? Well, because Brett's smarter than that. Brett knows that young people are now on YouTube watching videos. They're not listening to podcasts. Your young people don't listen to podcasts anymore than they probably use email. They're texting and watching YouTube. So he's working on that field so he understands the vision. Now, sometimes the videos that I've done a video with him on his STR Place videos he does, right? It's not like they're all that visually they don't need to be visually stunning with all kinds of special effects, but they are engaging because somebody's looking at you like they're talking to you, and they're giving you the answer, right? And it's amazing to me that young people still want that delivery rather than even the written words. He could very easily just write a blog post to cover that material, right? But he's chosen to use the video. So if it's me and I'm working with this group, I'd find a way to do two things. One is the arguments for God's existence and the quick responses to the top seven or five or eight, whatever they are, objections of atheists that the kids give you. So I would probably
survey.
Yes, I would start with a series on the arguments for God's existence. And while you're doing that for 5 or 8 weeks, whatever it is, you're giving the kids the surveys that'll provide you with the topics for the next series, which are the objections, the pushback that you might get for any number of these. That's probably where I would start with young people. And of course, you always are weighing this. This is how my struggle as a youth pastor, okay, for the years I did that, was weighing the value and the importance and the priority of teaching apologetics and helping my young people to be biblically literate. Because typically what we do as youth pastors is we make a decision between these two, and we're usually better in one area than the other. And I didn't want that to be the case with my young people. So what I would do is I would say, okay, if we're going to do line by line through the scriptures, we're going to pick those scriptures that I'm most concerned that my young people are unfamiliar with the scriptures of these four or five areas, and we're going to do those one day a week at midweek, pardon me, in a more relational setting. And we sometimes have a bigger turnout at midweek than we would have on Sunday, because I don't know why, that maybe friends who maybe went to a different church would come with their friends at midweek, but we'd have a huge turnout. And that's where we would break into groups of, you know, 6 to 8 to 10 and go through scripture line by line. And so we tried to be careful not to give up one good thing to chase another. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think really, at least in my situation, our main service, which will not run concurrent to our youth service, covers the line by line study of the Bible. So it's pretty much, up to whatever I decide in terms of what we're going to do. So hopefully we're going to be focusing on, like you said, the objections that the students have, because it's not very big, you know, 20 or so students, but they're going to be going to college soon. And I know when I went to college, it was easy for me going from a nominal Christian household and then being bombarded by, you know, naturalism. I don't want those kids to go through the same thing that I went through, and, you know, not having any grounding or foundation in philosophy, that kind of thing. So
Yeah, well, there's
really
two,
where my heart is at.
Right, there's two things about that then. And Jared, this is where you're going to have to really make the push. What I had noticed in those settings where you've got a regular service, so it's kind of like a family service, and kids are allowed in that service, youth are allowed in that service with their parents, and somebody's going line by line through Scripture. And then you have your youth service at, 5 o'clock in the afternoon or some other time. That the trick is going to be for you to value the family service in which line by line preaching is being done, and demonstrate that value to your students and attend those with your students. Because I think what typically happens when you separate these two is that kids stop going to one or the other. They just do.
Right.
And if they're thinking, well, I could go to that line by line boring Bible stuff, or I could go to this thing over here, which is designed for me and for my age group, and my friends are all, where are they going to choose to go? I can go and sit with my parents in the service. And this is the draw. This is the issue. And we've got to find a way as leaders of youth to show the high value of that teaching. And that's why I suggest, and we have always talked about this, there are two foundational trips you have to take with your students. And you have to take some kind of a trip that helps to kind of catechize them, that helps to show them the importance of knowing their Bible, and some kind of a trip that helps them to understand the importance of knowing reason and philosophy. And,
right.
And so this is why we designed the Utah trip and the Berkeley trip, right? These two trips are really good at bringing out the best in your students. So when they fall short at Utah, you can simply say to them, well, that's because you guys aren't spending enough time in your Bible. You can't defend what's in your scripture as well as your LDS opponent can defend what they think is true from their scripture. And to be honest, they're going to dip into your scripture anyway, and they're even beating you in your own scripture. How's that feel? That doesn't feel good. So what you need to do is be spending time in your Bible. So you're able to, and once a student has been through that process, trust me, they become committed to not feeling that way again, because it feels so terrible, right? So there's two things you're going to have to do quickly if you're going to lead a youth group, I think. Number one is be committed to both these two prongs of apologetics and biblical literacy. And then two, stop teaching. Stop teaching. I tell this to everybody. Don't teach anymore. Train. All you do is train. It's this idea that you are, we see with fighters, that in between fights they get fat, right? We know that because once they sign for the next fight, now they train for 8 weeks. They're training because they don't want to look bad in the ring. And this is what happens to our young people too. We need to give them a ring event that they see is coming, and then we're going to train for that event. And it may just be that you have to say, well, we're not going to be able to go to Berkeley, but whatever your college campus is that's closest to you, we are going to go there in 8 weeks on a Saturday,
right.
Spend the whole day there, and you can either choose now to train and hold your own or look like a fool. Your choice. And people will be motivated.
What about for the
train.
Kids?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what about for the kids that, their parents bring them, but they're, I guess, resistant or maybe even contrary in their attitude, they don't want to be there. Do you just like set that goal, say we're going to be going on this trip, everybody that's Christian train up, and then kind of set the other kids aside? Or
I think it's, you're always going to
include them.
Right, you're always going to have a group that might even attend your, that's why we never set up training really. I'm not a big fan of putting training in some other time frame. I like to train during the period of time in which we actually meet, because now everyone's getting the training, even if they're not necessarily going to go on the trip. They're still getting the training.
Right.
But when I start in all these training endeavors, this is a strategy to why we do things the way we do it. We always do a role play prior to even announcing a trip and prior to start training for a trip. Now, at first, you can do a role play, but after you've done it once, you're probably going to bring in the real McCoy to work with your kids. Because I think what happens is those kids who are even on the fence, once they've been in that room where they've seen an atheist challenge their friends who are Christians, who are really committed Christians, and beat the dog snot out of them because their Christian friends weren't really ready to answer the objections of this atheist in their midst, it motivates your kind of solid Christian kids to want to do better. And it also emboldens some of your kids who are more apathetic or maybe even not quite convinced, because they want to see, well, are there really any good Christian answers? I agree with that guy, what he just said, And especially when the role player at the end announces he's really somebody like Brett, who's somebody who actually is a Christian who's just role playing. That kid who's sitting with his own skeptical doubt realizes that this Christian in front of me was able to overcome the very objections that he offered. That's powerful. And I think you're more likely to engage people in the training and in the trip, the ring event that you've got set up afterwards. You're more likely to engage them if you begin with role playing. So that's why the stuff you hear that Brett and Alan and I do with young people is not just because we like to go and mess with young people, although that part is fun too. But it really has a purpose, and the purpose is to get them excited and to motivate them to want to sit through the, 'cause the training. I would tell them too is, you know what? If you watch a boxer when he trains, in the moment of the training, when you're doing your crunches and you're doing your push-ups and you're hitting the heavy bag and you're being hit by your sparring partner, that stuff is no fun. And it's not like I would choose to get up tomorrow and train for 6 hours to go into a fight, because it means I'm going to get beat up a little bit. I'm going to get extremely tired. It's not going to be easy. But there's something that I'm willing to do because I know the payoff is big. So what we have to do as Christian leaders of young people is help them to see that the payoff is going to be big, to help them get excited about that process. And what I discovered, honestly, Jared, is that when I presented the ring event, we're going to go to Berkeley, and it's going to be this hard, and you're going to be in front of this group, and we're going to put you on the stage, and you're going to have to be debating these kids. They're like going, oh, my gosh, this is like they're scared to death and in a good way. In an exciting way. You and I, as old folks, when we hear that, we go, yeah, I don't want to take my vacation time for that. It's not that big of a deal. But young people go, wow, I'm going to have some bragging rights when this is all done. I'm going to be able to actually do this. I'm going to be able to say that I did that. And that's a motivator for a lot of young people. And I think we got to capitalize on that energy. And let's face it, I tell young pastors of youth whenever I'm in a conference setting, that they have the best job in the church, and they have the most important job in the church, in my view, is they're preparing, and they've got a group of kids who will do anything they ask them to do. Don't lose that. Take advantage of that. They will do what you ask them to do, and they're excited for the challenge in a way that you and I as adults are usually less than excited, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
I hope that helps you, Jerry, as you kind of think through those issues.
Definitely. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
We need more of you out there, Jared, doing the hard work of youth ministry. It's really the most important job in the church. I appreciate you, bud. Talk to you. Give me a call or anytime you want to. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Okay. As we are now at the end of this next break, we've got somebody waiting. Marty's waiting on the other line from Beaumont. We'll get to you in just a second, Marty. We'll take a break right now and come back here at Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these 3 self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim Mission. This is a 4-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
sitting in for Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, taking a stand for the things that matter most in life, as Greg is in Hungary today. Thanks for all of you who have called so far. Let's talk to Marty in Beaumont. And Marty, you're calling about same-sex marriage. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's Jim?
Yes, it is.
Okay, Jim. You've done this program before a few times, haven't you?
I have, yes. I'm always nervous when I get asked.
Officer?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Okay, yeah, I've enjoyed you when you've been on.
Oh, well, thanks so much. I appreciate
it. And I also enjoyed that bit of information on teaching young people. I'm a 66-year-old youth pastor.
Wow, that's the best way to be. See, I myself didn't start youth pastoring. I was until about my 40s, or maybe, yeah, I guess I was 40. And I felt like the oldest youth pastor on the planet. Of course, that's not true. There are lots of us out there who
You're
are
not.
Doing this work. Right, yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm not officially that, but I teach middle school students. I've got some really bright students, and that the information you gave on the combination of apologetics and theology was very helpful, and I do agree with that.
Yeah, it's really important.
The point I wanted to make is I kind of, you know, I'm a big Dennis Prager fan, and Dennis
too.
Feels that we are, well, then you know Dennis's argument that we're fundamentally changing an institution that's millenniums old with almost no evidence of the long-term effects on children, because obviously heterosexual marriages are the way the majority of kids are brought up. And I was thinking of something the other day, and I was going over with my wife. If you say that the GLBT, and they use all four of those, population is roughly 5%, which I would say it's probably high. And out of that, if you have just 5% of that population, and you would say that 10% of them would want to get married. I think that's maybe a reasonable figure. Maybe you go to 15%, maybe you go high to 20%. But that is a very, very small. So based on 10%, that only represents half of 1% of those that want to get married. Out of that half of 1%, how many of those are going to be raising children? I mean, we are talking about a portion of the population that we are experimenting with raising of our next generation.
That's actually a very good point, Marty. And I'll tell you what, my kind of weigh in on this too is that that's a point that Dennis made just in the last couple of weeks, is that the low percentage of people we're really talking about that we're prepared to change an entire institution for is pretty dramatic. And I think you're right about that. I think it is. I mean, even the demographics that I've been looking at, and one time Dan Black's did a survey called The Demographics of the Gay and Lesbian Population. And for a long time, that was the standard work that was done. And that identified the male homosexual population at 2.5% and the female homosexual population at 1.4%. And then of that small percentage now, we're talking about a total of, what, 3.9%. Of combining mm-hmm. those two sets of numbers. They did a census in 2000, so it's a little old now. It's about 10 years old. So I'm not sure if we can really rely on these kinds of figures. But at that time, about 33% of the female homosexual households and about 22% of male homosexual households were actually raising kids. So it's a very small percentage, a little bit, you know, of the population, obviously, and less than half the percentage of the small, you know, demographic that's actually claims, you know, identifies themselves as homosexual. So we are looking at a very small group here. But the question is that are we prepared to do something to promote the size of that group? Do we want that group to be larger? Do we want when we talk about what government promotes, what we're really saying is that the government wants more of that thing. And I think that the argument for me here is that really it's what is it that is the definitive thing that identifies marriage distinctly and uniquely? Is it because that's where committed relationships occur? I don't think that's what it is. Is it because that's where sexual relationships occur? I mean, you don't have to have a marriage license to have either one of those. It's really about the raising of young people, the raising of children. And that's where I think we need to focus our conversation is now I'm going to tell you, I wrote an article on this in which I really looked at the comparative studies between the well-being of kids in each of the different kinds of family units. But the only problem I have with that approach, honestly, Marty, is that I think it takes a long time to describe it. So if I'm having coffee with somebody and somebody throws out a simple question, I really wanted to develop a response that I could communicate in 10 minutes, not in, you know, 10 hours. And that's the, you know, to look at the survey of research on this issue, and all of it will favor loving, low conflict, biological families. All of it favors.
Where can I get that article?
Well, I posted it on the Hot Topics section. It's an article called Please Convince Me. It's called Should Government Recognize and Legalize Same-Sex Marriage? And the work I did is about.
Please Convince Me.
Yeah. Yeah, it
and
is.
What is your website again?
It's just pleaseconvinceme.com. But I'll post on Twitter. And I know that Greg's written stuff on this as well. And I just tried to spend some time accumulating all the statistical research. And, boy, it took forever to do it. And I remember in our church, we were simply looking at this issue. Maybe it was Prop 8, around the time of Prop 8. I forget what the reason was we started looking at this. And so I would say that this data is probably now about 4 or 5 years old. So I think that you have to have some caution when you're using data as to where it's coming from. But I think that this is why the argument I made earlier in the first hour, where we did a little opening monologue on a brief case for traditional marriage. If you go back and listen to that, you'll see that that argument does not rely on statistical numbers. It's simply that I think everyone intuitively recognizes that it's always better when kids are raised in a low conflict, loving setting by their biological parents. And even me, as an adoptive father, I can't raise I can't even accomplish that, right? I mean, I'm not the biological parent. I think we do a good job, and we're the next best thing, maybe. But what would have been far better is for each child to be raised by his two biological parents in a low-conflict, loving setting. So if that's the thing that's best for kids, that's the one thing I want to honor as the ideal. And that's what I'm. That my focus would be is, you know, any conversation is, hey, I think both sides would agree on that. Even a same-sex union where somebody adopts, they would probably also agree. It'd be far better for kids to have their biological parents, wouldn't it? And of course it is. So all we're saying is that this title of marriage that we give, this institution of marriage that we describe in our culture, is the one thing that can separate this union from all others and promote this one thing that we see as the ideal. And that's I think, the better way to make the case. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I do agree with you on that. It's just that the experiment of raising kids raising kids outside of a heterosexual traditional family, it takes such a chance, and the statistics for long-term effect, it just simply aren't there.
Yeah, well, I hope that I agree with you, and I hope that article does help you. But I want to move on to one last caller before the end of the hour. Thanks so much for your call. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's move over now to last call of the hour. Larry, who's calling. Are you calling from York in California, Larry?
New York, California.
Got it. Okay. Good to talk to you. Actually, I was just talking to Melinda a little bit. I've listened to your phone calls to Greg here in the past, and to my mind, you're a bit of a, I don't know, just a kind of a stand to reason celebrity in some sense. So I want to make sure I got
am?
To you. Well, I think so, and your story is just so compelling, and I want to get to your statement here about slavery. Man, you probably teach me something.
Yeah,
it's
it's a kind of an interesting story. But
yes.
The thing I wanted to, you know, I basically agree with you, of course, about what you were saying about biblical slavery, but I think you failed to draw a distinction between New Testament slavery and Old Testament slavery.
Yes, that's what you call it. I want you to go ahead and tell that
for me. Because the situation for the Hebrew slave was much, much different than in the Greek or Roman slave.
So now when you say Hebrew slave, do you mean that the slaves that Hebrews owned or the times when which...
The slaves the Hebrews owned, whether they were Hebrews or
pagan
Gentile.
Or, yes, go ahead.
What we hear the most about from, like, in Paul's epistles, mm-hmm. and Timothy and Titus and so on, is are is the New Testament type slavery. That's Roman or Greek slavery.
Yes.
And slavery in the Hellenistic world was not a nice thing.
Correct.
It was an ugly thing. It was very exploitative.
Yes. No. I understand what you're saying. But let me offer this to you, Larry. So the question is this. What I think most of our skeptics who doubt, who would like to use the issue of slavery as a way to kind of disqualify what Scripture teaches, they would look at the slavery that's described that is governed by Old Testament law and say, you see, those the Old Testament actually promotes this form of slavery. What I would say is, yes, the Hellenistic slavery that occurred in the Roman Empire was probably horrific by comparison. But you're not going to find...
Actually...
Go ahead.
I thought he was probably talking about Paul's epistles.
No, he is. But here's my point, though, is it's not as though... what governs slavery in the Bible is Old Testament writings that govern slavery, right? So to make a case that Paul is writing about a form of slavery in New Testament times that is promoted by the biblical text, that he can't make. Because the kind of slavery that's described in the biblical text in the Old Testament is very different. It's true that Paul is writing in the context of New Testament slavery in the Roman Empire, which was very harsh. But that's not something that's written about and governed by Old Testament law. So in other words...
But he's still saying that slaves should obey their masters...
Right. Well, here's the other thing, too, is when he's talking – so we're talking about what letter when Paul says that?
I'm trying to remember.
It's Philemon, right? It's talking about
– I believe there's mentions of in Titus, in Timothy.
Correct.
Philemon.
Right.
There's mentions of slavery. You know better than I do.
Well, in Philemon, for example, you're talking about one person's form of slavery, and that's my whole question is, what is the set of conditions that put that slave – in that position? Of course, if we're Dan Savage, we're going to assume it's like New World conditions. He's captured against his will so that his master can benefit. But if it's in the tradition
right.
If this is a Jewish person who's come to Christ, who now owns a slave, the question becomes, is that really how that slave was taken into custody?
Judging by his name, he was Greek. Philemon. That's not a Jewish name.
So the question then becomes is what is the method by which this slave was entered into slavery? And if we ask Dan Savage, of course, he wants to make sure it's as close to New World slavery as it can be so we can make a monster of the New Testament. We would
say... in the Hellenistic world, the common way people became slaves is by prisoners of war.
Yeah, you know what I would love to do, now we're going to, of course, run against the last 1 minute I have here with you, is that if you look at the actual context of what it is he's telling the slave in that letter, okay... I think it's pretty clear there's a sense of indentured servitude here, a sense of a debt that needed to be paid, that needs to be forgiven. And this is, I think, consistent with what we see in the Old Testament, as described in the Old Testament law. So the question is not whether or not there's slavery in the New Testament, but is that form of slavery advocated by the New Testament? And Larry, I'm so sorry. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but of course, sometimes the best callers come in at the very last minute. So please forgive me as we end the second hour here at Stand to Reason. And next hour, we'll be talking to Jonathan Morrow, who wrote a book called Think Christian, which I can't wait to talk to him about, a friend of mine, who I think is going to be great. You're going to look forward to hearing from him. So next hour, Jonathan Morrow and Think Christianly right here on Stand to Reason. Glad to be back with you here today. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokol. Stand to Reason here on the American Family Radio Network. Clear Thinking Christianity, which I think is probably a great thing we have in common with Think Christianly, the book that's been written by Jonathan Morrow. And hopefully together, Jonathan and I will help you take a stand for the things that matter most in life. And I think I've got Jonathan here on the phone with me right now. So how are you, Jonathan?
Hey, doing great. How are you?
It's doing so good. It's so fun that we're here talking about this book because we just saw each other, what, about a month ago, I think it was, in Dallas?
Yeah, had a great time catching up.
No, that was awesome. We almost got chased out of the lobby of the hotel, though. We were in there after hours trying to sit in the lobby and just talk. I think it was with Mary Jo Sharp, wasn't it? And we got shushed out of there. You can't sit here. You got to leave. So I was glad to be able to talk to you now for an hour without anybody making us leave the radio station. So I'm just pulling up my bag of books here and pulling out all three of your books, which I brought with me. So, see, I'm a real fan, dude. I actually have all three of your books. Are you proud? Are you impressed?
I am. Thank you very much.
I do what I can. But anyway, so here we are. We're talking today. Now, I've got all three of them, and there's another good, really good book that's important for people to, which we're not going to talk about much at all today. It's called Is God Just a Human Invention, which you co-wrote with Sean McDowell. But that's also a great book. But today we're going to talk about a really important book you did called Think Christianly. And I'm familiar with the book. And, Jonathan, before I even begin, I want to make sure that people are familiar with you because I, of course, know a lot about you, and you've helped me out. You covered me in a conference last year in Alaska that I couldn't make at the last minute because my grandmother passed away, and you are a great friend to be able to do that for me. And you run a website called thinkchristianly.org. But rather than kind of describe who you are, of course, you're a founder of this great website, and you're a speaker, and you've written three books, Is God a Human Invention, and Welcome to College, and Think Christianly. And also, like me, you had a chance to contribute to the Apologetic Study Bible for students, so that was cool. But tell everybody now in this national audience a little bit about who you are and how you came to work in the setting you're working in now.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me on. It's really a pleasure to be here. But my journey really started, you know, in college, and I started engaging these issues as a Christian. I came to Christ at 17, and then as I went through the college years, I had a lot of skeptical professors, and I was searching for answers, and I knew that I wanted to serve the church. That was kind of clear. And then God really refined that through the years, and so I attended Talbot School of Theology. I did a Master's of Philosophy there and an MDiv, and really went on and been serving in the local church as an equipping pastor, working with students, working with high school and college students, as well as adults, trying to think about these issues of culture and the next generation and faith, understanding what we believe, why we believe it, why it matters in life. And so my journey really has been, how do we integrate all of this stuff together? And so my studies have been in that area. I'm completing a doctorate of ministry at Talbot under J.P. Moreland and Gary DeWeese and all those wonderful professors there.
Awesome.
So that's a little bit about my intellectual journey, and just so many people have invested in my life. But I'm in the local church setting. I've been married for 11 years now and have two awesome little kids. And so just my passion really is to help the next generation to think Christianly about all of life. I want them to have a mature faith, understand how to cooperate with God and transforming their heart and really having a radical love for their world. So that's me in a nutshell, I guess.
Awesome. Now, I know just from listening to you, you're one of the sweetest guys I know in terms of your delivery of these issues and the way you communicate these issues. And you and I have talked on the phone before, on Skype before, and talked about some of the great books you've written. And what I love about you is just that you have your kind of a boots on the ground approach to dealing with young people and seeing what they're struggling with. Is that why you decided to write this book right now? Why did you decide that this is the time for this book?
Yeah, because I really have a heart for, you know, seeing students have the confidence to engage because God has uniquely and strategically placed students to really become the leaders of the next generation. But what my fear was is that they're not being given a convincing vision for a compelling Christian life that includes the life of the mind, where they understand the issues of the day. They understand the Christianity and understand why it's true, reasons, how to think, not just what to think. But then, how do we connect that with the culture we live in? Because as I was looking around, people have different responses to culture. It's either run for the hills and pray for the rapture or attack and full on going after everybody attacking. But I think there's a better way to engage that's winsome, that's attractive, but it's also rigorous, that we offer reasons. And so we understand the issues of the day. We make careful distinctions. And that's what I love helping students do. And my own experience has been whenever we take the time to engage them at this level, it comes alive for them. Just a couple of weeks ago, one of the students in our ministry was talking about having a conversation with her a freshman in high school, and having a conversation with a biology teacher and asking that person, imagine a freshman in high school going up after class and saying, have you ever read anything on intelligent design? And actually asked the teacher. And she's like, no, I actually haven't. And so he came and through his dad found me and got him some articles. I printed off a real thick article by Stephen Meyer that was a rigorous article for her to read and some other things. But and then explained the distinctions between evolution and how it's used and how our teacher might be using it. So they're facing these issues younger and younger. And so in a nutshell, I guess, I wanted to give them a resource that really introduces them to the conversations being had from a Christian worldview perspective.
Awesome. Now that's I think really what we talk about all the time, what the power of this generation and how important it is to equip this generation. And there's a lot of parents who struggle with this. You know, what do I do with my student? As they get to high school years, you kind of wonder, first of all, should I have them in public high school? Should I be homeschooling? Should I be putting them in a Christian environment? Should I think about a college that's out there that's maybe a Christian university or Christian college? I do see a struggle on the part of parents to decide, you know, is it better for me to inoculate, to withdraw, to engage, you know, so let's just talk about some of the kind of inherent dangers there are in us when we decide that the best strategy we might take is to withdraw from the culture around us.
Right. Well, when we withdraw, what happens is we're missing out on a couple of fronts. One, as 2 Corinthians 5 makes clear, we're called to be everyday ambassadors. And it's hard to be an ambassador to a culture or to schools and people if we're never engaged with them. We just can't represent the claims of Christ if we're never engaged. So if we withdraw completely, we won't be able to connect. And I think we're being unbiblical if we do that. Paul's example is so clear. Acts 17, he understood the culture. He exegeted the culture. He understood the Christian worldview so well he could build bridges between the two. And the word that you picked, inoculate, I think was the most helpful one. I think what we must do is we want to have the first conversations with students about the challenges that they're going to be facing in an environment where they can process their doubts. Everybody has doubts. I've had doubts in my life. You know, we all face tough questions. If you've thought to any depth about Christianity, you've had questions. And so we want to, as parents and as the church, we want to create an environment where it's safe to ask those kind of questions, but we're also challenging them to think, because my fear is if we don't challenge them to think, then the first time that they get challenged with something that they're not used to, they've never heard before, their faith tends to wither in those circumstances. And so I think exposure is good. I think community is absolutely essential. So whether or not, you know, in Christians it's a matter of conviction and even access and some pragmatic issues about homeschool or public school or whatever that discussion, and each parent's going to make their own decision on that. But I think what must occur is there needs to be a group of students. Peers are so critical. Proverbs 13:20 says this, "He who walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools suffers harm." And they need to be around wise people who are running the race with them towards Christ and have some mentors a little bit further down the road that can help speak into their life. So as far as helping young people, we need to inoculate. We need to make sure we're putting them in the right kind of environments. Again, ultimately, they've got to make their own choices in that regard. But as a parent, what I want to do is make sure that there's some mentors in their life, some peers, that they understand what Christians actually believe, why they believe it, why it matters, and then a vision that's big enough to give their lives to. And that grounds them, and then we can send them out into the culture to make a difference for Christ.
Well, okay. Now, so did you have – I was greatly motivated. I got to tell you, I spent a year in youth ministry before I got it, before I figured this out. And then that first year, you know, I was really more concerned as an older guy trying to relate to young people. My kids were not quite high school age yet, so I was, you know, not sure I could even do this job. And I had an experience where I lost a bunch of kids in that first graduating class, did not stay Christians through the first semester in college. And it really opened my eyes. And it shook me up, quite frankly. Did you have a similar experience that motivated you, or was your background and kind of an apologetics through your undergraduate work, the work you've done at Biola Talbot, is that the stuff that really motivated you, or did you have an experience like I did that kind of brought the, you know, made it all clear to you how important this was?
Yeah, well, I'll share a firsthand experience. It really became clear for me in college. My freshman year, I was attending a large state school, Tennessee, large liberal arts college, 25,000 students. They have these classes that are university studies or university 101, which is kind of the, hey, welcome to college life. Here's the library. Go to sleep at some point. Eat something. Trying to give you some helpful tips along the way. And about halfway through the semester, it came up on controversial issue day. And the way this worked and played out was, is okay, if you believe this, get on this side of the room. If you believe that, get on that side of the room. And so I knew it was coming. And remember, I came to Christ at 17, so I've been a Christian about a year and a half. I'm a freshman in college. Here's the question. As a Christian, you believe that all non-Christians are going to hell. So there I am as a freshman. So I get up. I walk to one side of the room. And there may have been one person behind me, but if they were, they didn't say anything. But the rest of my class was on the other side of the room. And they just started kind of heckling and mocking, and so you're judgmental and all that kind of stuff. And the teacher let it go on. I was like, well, as a Christian, you believe that all you believe what Jesus had to say. And Jesus claimed that I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. And that's about all I could get in before they kind of overtook it. And the teacher actually let that go for about a minute or two. So that was an experience I had as a freshman, where I realized that, okay, if Christianity is actually true, I need to be prepared to engage this. And by God's grace and His Holy Spirit that day, He gave me the courage to stand up in that environment, which I give Him all the glory for. But students are facing these real kind of challenges, and so we must prepare them. And so that kind of spurred me on and even led me to write Welcome to College. I even told my wife when I graduated, hey, if God ever opens the door, to write down all the stuff I wish I would have known to fill in all those blank pages on my journey. That's what I wanted to do with Welcome to College, the first book that I wrote, to really help students navigate those waters. And that just kind of permeated my whole ministry since then, and my passion is really to help see the next generation flourish in those ways.
Well, okay, in your experience, though, with young people, have you seen that there have been either, you know, leaders out there or friends and associates? We all have friends who work in youth ministry, and at some point, most of us have probably done more to adapt to our culture than we have to inoculate or to engage it in a thoughtful way. I found myself doing that as well. So I guess, are you seeing that, you know, obviously we know there's a certain danger in doing that, right? I mean, in adapting to our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens is we become so immersed in it and like it that we lose the distinctively Christian part. That's the danger. Because the problem is we become so immersed, so trying to reach certain people, that if we're not grounded and if we don't have community and accountability and a vision that's bigger than that moment, then the tendency is we can get swallowed up in that. So, yeah, I totally see that as a danger.
Well, and, you know, we keep on talking about this, like everybody understands what we're talking about when we say culture. But that word is, I think, not really properly defined sometimes, and it seems to be a big word that doesn't have a lot of shape to it. So when you're using this word culture, what do you mean by it?
Yeah, I think that's the place to start, because I took some time at the beginning of Think Christianly to really kind of flesh this concept out, because sometimes people think that Christians are against culture, when in fact we're not. But to properly define it, the best, most transferable definition I came across was from Andy Crouch, and culture is simply this: what people make of the world. And Jesus of Nazareth was part of a culture. So we're not against culture per se. It's impossible for us not to be involved in culture. What Christians are to be against is the world system in which any idea or image or worldview that leads people away from life with God and towards being consumed with life with self. That's really what the world is. So when you see that theological term in the scripture, that's what we're against, those ideas and images. So culture, we're actually supposed to be culture makers in a sense, because of the creation mandate in Genesis 1, where we're supposed to make something of the world for the glory of God. That was the original mandate for humanity, and made in God's image. We're creative image bearers. And so culture is not a bad thing. We can't not be involved in culture. The distinction is the world system, and that's what we inoculate against. That's what we challenge. That's what we try to expose.
Okay, makes sense. That's a word I think that most of us, when we hear that word, we can assume any number of things. And I think you'd have to admit that the culture that I'm a lot older than you, but the culture that I had to deal with growing up was very different. I wasn't involved in a church setting. And so if you'd have asked me about questions in culture, I would have had a very different response for you. I think I thought of Christians and how they were interacting in the culture. I had a very negative experience and a very negative perspective on Christians growing up from the people I knew. But I think that you'd have to admit that every generation deals with its own specific set of circumstances, its own specific set of influences on the culture. And so now I think we're clearly in an information age. I mean, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I am able to tweet on Twitter. I've got my laptop open. I usually have my iPad here. My iPhone it's ridiculous. Okay. It's ridiculous. But how has this information age really kind of changed the way that all of us experience, especially Christians, experience culture?
Yeah. I think in two large ways. First, immediate access. Information happens so quickly. I mean, think of Twitter, for example. Early adopters of that was more pedestrian, hey, what did I do today? But then you'll notice that all the news services, if you want to get the word out quickly, you use Twitter.
That's right.
And just the amazing amount of speed and information and access. And so everyone has access. It levels the playing field. You know, a couple of years ago, that book that came out, The World Was Flat. Well, that idea is, the student in rural Nebraska has the access to the same information that the student in urban New York City does, or L.A. And so they have access to the same issues, world religions, arguments, news, all the secular kind of stuff, the new atheists and everything in between. And so their world is they have to process that. So that's the first thing, is immediate access. The second thing is it's constant. I mean, we live in a 24-hour news cycle with the digital media and everything else that comes with it, it's impossible to get away, but it's imprinting itself on us, all of these images, ideas, concepts. And so if we're not careful, we can begin to get shaped by that river of information that's really washing over our soul on a daily basis. So the fact is the information age really has changed things. I mean, when I speak to students now, I just got back from a Christian high school and talking about welcome to college and things like that, about how to prepare. And one of the things I remind them of that I didn't have to deal with, and that other generations didn't have to deal with, is the idea of having a digital footprint. The fact that you have a Facebook timeline that your future spouse will access. And they'll see all of the stuff. So don't break up with your girlfriend on Facebook, right? Don't talk about her. I mean, all those things, that's part of your story. I mean, jobs, interviewers are saying, hey, can we look at your Facebook page now? I mean, all of that is just all these challenges, and that's a cultural issue. Facebook is a cultural artifact. There's nothing inherently evil about Facebook. It can be used for good or ill, but it has certain impact on us, and those are the kind of things we have to be aware of.
Awesome. Okay, well, I want to take a break here at our first break of the hour. And when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about the kind of intersection of theology and culture with our guest here today, Jonathan Morrow, who's written three books. The most recent book, Think Christianly, is the topic of our conversation today. We'll be back here in 2 minutes on Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
What kind of faith are you passing on to your young people? Is it blind and irrational, or is it reasonable? This is Brett Kunkel, and in this month's Bulletproof Podcast, I'll discuss the biblical view of faith young believers need to hear from us. Download Bulletproof from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
I'd like to extend to you an invitation to join with some others who are making a significant difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. And there is a special group of strategic partners who become the solid foundation of STR's ability to work effectively. Strategic partners are just what the name implies, people who've committed their regular financial support for Stand to Reason so that we can plan effectively to take advantage of opportunities for training and equipping. Now, they accomplish this by pledging to make a gift to Stand to Reason each month. If you'd like to become a part of this important group, just call 1-800-2-REASON today for more information. And we've selected some gifts of appreciation for those who stand with STR monthly as a strategic partner, and we'd like to give them to you. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about, both in the world and in the church, consider becoming a strategic partner today. Training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their faith and values. So call STR at 1-800-2-REASON to find out how you can sign up to become a strategic partner.
Back here at Stand to Reason, Jay Warner Wallace talking with Jonathan Morrow about his new book, Think Christianly. It's not actually new, I guess, is it, Jonathan? It's been out for a little while, right?
Yeah, it came out last November, so So it's been out for a little while, but it's been fun to see it pick up steam.
Good, and I should say the latest book. Isn't it nice to be able to be an author now and people can say, we're talking about your latest book? Isn't that cool?
Well, I give God all the glory, man.
Well, of course, we always do that because we're Christians, but come on, I know you're like...
It is gratifying in the sense to work hard and labor, and you know this as well. I mean, you've got books coming out yourself, and so it is gratifying to use those gifts and have people be encouraged and equipped by them.
That's a little closer to the kind of self, to the statement I was trying to coach out of you, but okay, that's pretty good. No, I think you have some things here that you've done that I think are unique and powerful. Let's talk, though, about we're talking about culture and what's important with young people and how the culture has changed and the fact that immediate access and constant access has really changed the culture that we live in. That's so true because it's recently, I was listening to some radio interview, and it was an important official on, I forget what show it was, and he's a government official, and they had asked him if he was aware of this particular current event that had just occurred maybe about 12 hours earlier, and he said, you know, I've been flying and I haven't had a chance to go back and check my Twitter. And so he's looking at Twitter as a source for all kinds of content and news content, and I think all of our young people are doing the very same thing, and it's constant. So that's very, very true. Now let's just talk, though, about how theology and how our understanding as Christians of theology is connected and wrapped up in the way we engage the culture.
Yeah, and that is where I really wanted to start in this book. So I took the time because we don't want to just engage culture because it's trendy or because it's perceived to be cool. We want it to be biblical, thoroughly biblical. And so I wanted to develop a theology of culture in the first couple of chapters. So in chapter 2, that's what I do, and I kind of lay out these four basic principles, biblically speaking, that ground our cultural engagement. Now, the first one, as I discovered as I read the scriptures, was this idea of being kingdom citizens. Where, you know, the Apostle Paul is clear that, I mean, our citizenship is in heaven. Philippians 3:20, we've been transferred from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of the beloved Son. So as Christians, we are distinctive because of God, His kingdom, His word, His revelation. We're weird for the right reasons. We're not obnoxious. We're not countercultural just to be countercultural. We are distinctively Christian. And so wrapped up in this idea of being a kingdom citizen is this idea that our allegiance is first and foremost to Christ and to God, but also that we understand that there's a particular true Christian story that we're to understand. And that's the starting point. The second biblical principle that I developed, and I go into more detail in the chapters, but is that we're everyday ambassadors. Again, there's no days off. Everyone gets to play. One of the things as a pastor, which I'm constantly trying to encourage people, is look, everybody is called to be a Christian. We're all ambassadors. We're all supposed to engage. This isn't just for the paid professionals. But what everyday ambassadors do is they build bridges between the kingdom story, which is the true story of reality, and the particular cultural issue of our day. Now, that requires that we understand what we believe and we understand our own story, but we also need to see what's going on in culture so that we can connect to it and build bridges in between. Third, the idea of cultural engagement is grounded in being creative image bearers. And this is where something where honestly where I think Christians we've not done as well, even this past, 50, 75 years, where we're called to make something of the world for the glory of God. We are to create good culture. We're to do something with it. The arts is a key area where culture is created, but unfortunately many Christians have run away from or they've divorced from their Christian worldview and their artistic expression. We need to recover that. And then finally, we need to be a community of radical love. The Bible just honestly doesn't make us choose between cultivating a thoughtful faith on the one hand and a radical love on the other. And so many times when you see books written on culture and things like that, you usually have, it's a heavy good works emphasis where we're doing good things, and we ought to do good things because of who God is and the gospel and things like that. But we also need to proclaim the good news. And we cannot effectively love our neighbor if we're never willing to tell them the truth. And so those four things form the planks of our cultural engagement from a biblical perspective, and I really felt it was important to have those center the discussion.
No doubt about it. Now, we talked a little bit about being creative image bearers, and I know that Doug Powell lives out there in Tennessee as well. Is he anywhere close to you? Do you know Doug?
Yeah, I know of him. Yeah, he's in Nashville. Our paths haven't crossed yet, though, but I look forward to that.
Yeah, because he was on 2 weeks ago, and some of the bumper music you've been listening to that gets us in and out of our interview is all from Doug. He actually is a musician, artist, of course. He's done a lot of things. But anyway, I just thought I would ask you if you knew him, since you know how it is when you have somebody who's in the same state, and they'll say, oh, you live in California. Do you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah. There's like about a billion people here. I figured, you're in Tennessee. You must know Doug. So anyway, stupid question. But let's just take a kind of a weird turn in some of this, because I think one of the things your book does well is not just develop an outline or a strategy in which to kind of look at culture and worldview, but it also does, I think, a pretty good job, and so does your other book, by the way, is God Just a Human Invention. That's a great book also. But it takes a look at certain key issues that are really critical if we're going to embrace the Christian worldview as true. If we think this worldview is actually the correct view of the world, there are certain foundations it's built upon, and those foundations seem to be under attack by our culture. So, for example, there's this debate over Adam, right, the historical Adam and Eve. I see it a lot. We see it a lot with BioLogos, with other Christians who are now debating whether or not, discussing whether or not this is a real historical Adam even existed. So how do you respond to those who – this is a foundational issue, I would assume, in our worldview. We all know it is. So how do you actually respond to those who either challenge or ask if Adam and Eve ever really truly existed historically?
Yeah, and that is a critical issue, and people are talking about it quite a bit. And so, from the first thing, remember, as a kingdom citizen, what is part of the true story of Christianity? Well, Paul and Jesus affirmed a historical Adam and Eve. Paul makes it a centerpiece of theology in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15. So this is not something that we can simply dismiss or dispense with as incidental to the Christian faith. So. Genesis, the early chapters of Genesis are clear on that. So theologically, we have to, Acts 17, we have to have a first set of human parents that are made in the image of God. So that's a critical plank in the discussion. Now, how this has played out recently is very interesting because, as you know, there's a lot of discussion with, BioLogos and other people like that and Francis Collins about these issues about, well, genetically speaking, there couldn't be an original pair. There had to be a big group or a large group. And what's interesting is a lot of that discussion is shaped by the assumptions. But let me just give a parallel case to help the listener kind of track with this. Because for a long time, there was this discussion around the myth of junk DNA. There's the idea of junk DNA, basically out of the human genome, a lot of it was junk that's just accrued over time because of natural selection and all these genetic replication and mutations. That it just didn't do anything. And Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project and now a prominent public official and a Christian, has affirmed at that time that, he affirmed his view on junk DNA. However, he's since changed his view on that to say, well, actually, no, that does more than we thought it did. And a lot of that has to do with assumptions and further understanding of what's going on. And so the same thing can happen when we start talking about mitochondrial Eve and all these technical discussions But a lot of the where you're going to end up in that discussion is where you begin and the assumptions that you make. It's kind of like this. If you've ever been in a pond or a creek, it's clear, but if you kind of dig up the silt on the bottom, it kind of muddies everything. Well, the naturalistic commitments, the understanding that has muddied the waters in this whole conversation so that it's hard to even get at, okay, what are the actual assumptions being made and what's the actual empirical evidence? And so that, there's plenty of discussion and plenty of people doing good work on that. And Gager at thebiocomplexity.org. I know Fuzrana has written some on this. So Christians are engaging that issue, but there's still plenty more that we need to learn about that. So there's no good reason that I've found to reject a historical Adam and Eve.
I was going to ask you too, Jonathan, who you actually go to as sources of information on both sides of that issue. And I agree with you. I think Fuzz is probably I think I'm still waiting for him to actually write something specifically about this issue. I haven't seen anything large come out yet. His podcast, though, he's covered quite a bit of it on podcasts, but I'm still waiting for a book or something that'll really kind of give us some direction. But I think, like you said, there's a lot of this that's built on assumptions and foundations, and I think he's waiting to see what the foundations really end up shaking out to be. It's almost too early to get involved in the discussion at all.
It is, and the way, and this is some advice that Daryl Bach, he's a historical Jesus study, historical Jesus scholar, Dallas Seminary, phenomenal New Testament scholar, but his advice, whether it's historical Jesus issues, and I think they apply to origins of life issue as well, is you're going to see all the headlines, the news stories, the blog posts, and then the wild claims, the conspiracy theories, the earth-shattering stuff, right? He's like, okay, let it settle. Let peer review happen. Let the critical engagement happen, and then start arriving at your conclusions after all the hype. And so, when these stories first began breaking, even last year, about evangelicals and should we give up on historical Adam and Eve, it's still really young in that discussion because it's, again, like you said, where do you dial in the assumptions versus the empirical evidence? One book I highly recommend is by a scholar, C. John Collins. Did Adam and Eve really live? I believe, or did really exist through Crossways? Is an excellent book as well.
Well, what's interesting too, and about the structure of your book here, is that you've really done a lot. You've kind of borrowed from a Lee Strobel approach in terms of interviewing key players who can help you navigate the issues that you're writing in each chapter. So, you had to pick these folks, and almost every chapter has got an interview with somebody who's an expert in the field that you're discussing. So, did you have to do some travel in order to do that? How did you actually make that happen?
You know, that's one of the great things about living in the information age is we can connect in ways that are a lot easier that didn't have to travel. But I just started contacting people that I'd love to have engage with the process. And so whether that was Kelly Monroe Kohlberg of the Veritas Forum, C. John Collins, like I just mentioned, Old Testament scholar, William Lane Craig, Sean McDowell, Jay Richards, who's an incredible resource on God and economics and all the issues related to that, Scott Klusendorf on bioethics. So there's plenty of stuff out there. Well, that was part of the really fun part of this book was getting to hear from these people who are experts in their field as well and having them weigh in, you know, finding out about next generation stuff with John Stone Street at the summit and the point and things like that. So interacting via email and things like that, it became great to start these discussions because, again, my heart behind this was to introduce Christians and leaders and students and pastors to put this book on their shelf and say, okay, who are the people that I need to start reading in these areas? Because Christians are doing great work all across the field. And so this is really an introduction to the conversation that's happening and some places to start to go deeper. I don't pretend to go as deep as you can go in each chapter, although I try to have a substantive interaction, right? But then I go, hey, here's where you go next, and here's why this matters.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. I've often said that when we're trying to figure out, you know, where we fit in this world of apologists that are out there who are so well-trained and each one's got an area of expertise. And I think I've always considered myself, kind of like Greg, I think, considers himself also to be a translator. Our job is to make sure we can make this accessible to people when there are expert witnesses I might call on a court case. But as the prosecutor has to make sure that he's able to translate what the expert witnesses say so the jury can actually put their hands around it. it. And I think a lot of that's what we're doing here. And I always kind of look at these things as kind of as the gateway drugs that get you into hardcore apologetics in certain areas. You had to pick, I guess, Jonathan, the areas that you thought were important to address in your book. So it seems to me you must have seen a number of other issues that you thought were really going to be a danger, or present a challenge, at least, to the Christian worldview. So tell me, what are the other issues that you thought were worth our consideration?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think one thing was injustice and this idea of whole social justice. How do we ground that in the gospel and in a rich theology of the Old Testament that allows us to see God's heart for, say, the orphan and the unjust circumstances or the widow, but also doesn't confuse the gospel in the sense of beginning a relationship with Jesus Christ and the atonement, all those things that are central to it. How do those interact? And so had a chapter on good news about injustice and how that plays out. Economics, I mean, our culture's been talking about the Occupy Wall Street stuff and bailouts and everything. So is, what does Christianity actually have to say about that? Are there principles within the Christian worldview? Because here's, and maybe this will help, the big picture idea of what I mean by think Christianly is this, that Christianity actually rises to the level of being true or false. There are good reasons to believe that it's true, and if it is true, then it speaks to every area of life. And so the assumption that I'm operating with is that if it's Christianity is true, and I believe that it is, and I think there's good reasons for that, then it speaks to areas like economics and the unborn and justice and bioethics and all those things, economics, questions of faith and science, issues of sexuality and the whole gay marriage debate and things like that. Those are prominent issues right now. So how do we make the case there? How do we be good ambassadors in a culture that thinks we're bigoted just for bringing up a truth claim? And how do we love well in the midst of that? And one of the ways that I try to tackle this in the book is have the right conversation in the right order when it comes to that issue. The first is, what does the Bible actually say about God's design for sex and sexuality, and even the homosexuality issues related to it? That's a biblical understanding kind of question. The second question, which requires a different answer, is how do we respond to those who struggle with sin, which we all struggle with sin. We're all broken. We just express our brokenness in different ways, and some of those are expressed in same-sex attraction, those kind of things. And so how do we struggle well, and how is the church, do we love well? Well, that's a different kind of question. Then the third question is, okay, well, how does that affect society, and what does it mean to love my neighbor and stand up for things that are good for society, like marriage between one man, one woman for a lifetime, and that's good so that a child can be raised in that home, and that's the number one determining factor for poverty is whether or not there's a father in the home or not, and things like that. So, but those are three different cases, and even that's a test case on how we as Christians need to be discerning and make important distinctions so that we're answering the right questions. So if they're asking us about the same-sex marriage debate, we don't necessarily need to start rattling off Bible verses because they're not asking that question. If our culture doesn't speak that language, as it were, then that's not where we need to go. We need to just make sure we're answering the right questions in the right order. So historical Jesus studies, I mean, you asked the question, but there's a lot of areas we need to tackle, and I tried to give a good broad introduction there and think Christianly.
Yeah, awesome. This is a good place to take a little break for our last segment coming up. I just want to talk to you about some places where maybe you've seen some signs of optimism, some places. You know, we always talk and we prepare as ambassadors and we prepare as apologists to be able to defend a challenge, and we often overlook the places where we're having some good success and places where we should be encouraged. I mean, be encouraging each other. We'll talk about that when we get back from this break. Sitting in for Greg Kokel, I'm Jay Warner Wallace with Jonathan Morrow, the author of Think Christianly. We'll be back in a couple of minutes here on Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ, and that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Last month, I took 17 Christian high school students on the Muslim mission. This is a 4-day trip where they got to practice their skills in apologetics and evangelism. Find out what happened on this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Get it from iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated subjects like evolution, cloning, stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador for Christ in a concise and attractive manner. So contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Or visit us on the web at www.str.org to request our newsletter, Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free when you call 1-800-2-REASON or visit str.org.
The music of Doug Powell, who shares a neighborhood in the state of Tennessee with my current guest, Jonathan Morrow, who wrote the book Think Christianly. And by the way, if you are following along with us on Twitter, get on over to STR Tweets right now. We're getting a drawing for 2 free copies we have to give away. But you got to get over to STR Tweets on Twitter right now. So I'm watching this to see if we have a ton of activity there, Jonathan. But I suspect that, you know, a free book, it's amazing what we'll do for anything that's free, huh? Maybe it's part of our culture. I don't know what it is. But a free book from Jonathan Morrow is worth us scrambling over. So get over there to STR Tweets. Okay, now let's talk about some areas of optimism, some areas of hope. So that I think that this show is really a show that is full of hope, because it helps people to understand that we've got good responses and good evidence and good reasons to believe what we believe about what happened in that first century region of the world in which Jesus spoke and demonstrated his divine nature. So tell me, give me some more hope that we can share with people about places where, you know, Christians are really actively and successfully engaging the culture.
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, I think we need to definitely cheer on the next generation, because they're starting to get it. I mean, I'm interacting with students, and they want to go deeper in these areas. We had a student who came through our ministry here and is now at Princeton and was able to defend his faith in a freshman seminar and actually defend a version of the Kalam cosmological argument as a freshman at Princeton. And it went well and earned the respect of his classmates and peers. And so as a first source of encouragement, I just want to encourage parents and students who are out there and church leaders and pastors, saying it's good to challenge your students and they can handle this stuff. Recently, it was the 20th anniversary of Talbot's philosophy program about last month when I was able to visit out there. And there's been over 300 graduates of that program, of the philosophy program, who are going out into philosophy programs and in academia and publishing in those areas. And because ideas have consequences and they trickle down. So that's an area in that regard. We've also got, honestly, I think Jay Richards is doing a phenomenal job in the economics part, in the awareness of worldview, because if we want to help people and do good work, good intentions are not enough. Good intentions by themselves don't produce good outcomes. I interviewed him in Think Christianly, and he's doing great work encouraging people there. I think churches are beginning to see that people want to ask and answer these kind of questions, and so my experience is that they're actually laying aside and setting aside time for people to have the courage to doubt their doubts, and it's a safe place to do that. More and more Christians, I think, are engaging, trying to be careful with the arts and try to be discerning in that regard. I think Brian Godawa is doing some great work on how do we understand film and engage that from a Christian perspective. And so there's a lot of exciting things. I mean, Summit Ministries is doing a phenomenal job training students in their worldview camps with John Stone Street. And there's some research that they've recently, as I was talking to Jeff Myers about this, president of Summit, that they're tracking and seeing students who go through and have an intensive understanding of worldview. They're walking the walk you know, years later, which is so encouraging. So I am encouraged. I'm hopeful. I know there's a lot of kind of stuff that we can get discouraged by, but there's a lot of great stuff happening out there.
Well, I think that's what you're talking about, too, in terms of the – I'd love to see the numbers. That's a great – would be a great survey, wouldn't it, to show us – we suspect this is true, but I want to know if there's any, you know, data – I guess we'll see it in the future – about what happens to young people who are empowered and have engaged these issues in the youth ministry setting when they go to college. I'm looking forward to that kind of stuff as well. But, you know, this is one of the things we talk about. What do you think – let me just ask you this question. I'm not sure you've not talked about before, of Ratio Christi, the movement, apologetics movement that seems to be sweeping across America on college campuses. Have you had any engagement with that?
Yes, I have. I've just been emailing back and forth a little bit about them to possibly kind of partner with them a little bit. And I'm a big fan of what they're doing. I think that's great to encourage students in their campus about how to kind of use Welcome to College a little bit to help them with that. And by the way, let me just share a quick plug on that for a limited time. I don't know how much longer. On Amazon Kindle, Welcome to College is available for $5. I don't know how much longer. So parents, graduation gifts, whatever, that might be a good option. But the idea that Ratio Christi has to engage and really provide a beachhead for a reasonable faith on a college campus is beautiful. I love it. And so I'm a big fan of theirs, and hopefully you'll be able to partner with them and encourage them in the days ahead.
Okay, well, I noticed you shamelessly squeezed in that shameless plug for your book, Welcome to College. Pretty smooth of you to do that. But I want to actually get to that book. But before we do, I want to ask you one last question about Think Christianly. You know, I know that most of us who write and who seek to kind of have our it's almost impossible. Your book is very complex in the sense that it's great and it's broad and it addresses a lot of different issues. So to ask this question may be a little unfair before we move to another book, but if someone's going to read Think Christianly and only remember one takeaway, one thing, what would you say that would be?
Yeah, if I just had one takeaway, and here's how I'd put it. The Bible doesn't make us choose between cultivating a thoughtful faith on the one hand and demonstrating radical love in our world on the other. We don't have to choose. We can do both. We're called to do both. And we may have certain gifting or passions or wiring and to kind of express in one way or the other, but both are part of what it means to be a mature follower of Christ. We don't have to choose between a thoughtful faith and radical love for our world.
Okay, now you know, this is, you've written now three books. That I think all of these books do the same kind of thing in that regard. They're all an effort to help people realize that that is the case. Of course, this last book is the book where you kind of summarize it in the most robust way. But let's go back to that book, Welcome to College, just before we finish today, because here we are at the end of a high school season, and lots of young people are graduating, and this is the challenge. I'm just going to put it to you. I see it as a challenge in all the youth groups I've ever worked with and with my own kids. And I've got kids now who have graduated college and are hardcore, I see them as future Christian apologists, okay? But I suspect if I was going to give them a book in their senior year, it might not get read. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the thing that – so I want to challenge this – of all the books I would give them, though, Welcome to College would probably be the one I would give them at this point in their high school life as they're getting ready to go to college, because I think so much is addressed in this book. Just tell people what your hope was with this book and why you think it's so important for their young people to read it.
Yeah, my hope with this book was really to give students and parents – and parents, there's about 42 different chapters with some appendices that are short, four-page chapters that deal with everything under the sun, from alcohol to dating to how can Jesus be the only way to the problem of evil to study habits to how to resolve conflict. Basically, it was my attempt to say, okay, if you're heading off to college, what do you need to know? And as a parent or a youth pastor, what my prayer is that you'd get this book and get, send them off with it. And even if they use it as a doorstop, there's going to be a day when they're going to have doubts. Well, there's a chapter on doubt. And, well, how do I grow spiritually? Well, there's a chapter on that. Well, what do I read? Well, I've given a first semester reading plan in the very back. What if I'm in a philosophy class? It's really tough. Well, I've given a whole appendix on top-notch Christian philosophers and really tried to put in one place, because the students aren't going to read the best 30 books out there on this topic. But especially with a digital and a Kindle or something like that, they'll read three or four pages and they'll get a substantive introduction to the issues, whether it's from evolution to intelligent design or arguments for God or how do we know things, truth. I mean, all that's covered in Welcome to College. And so my hope was is that students would be able to take that, go through it their senior year or the summer or even the freshman year and beyond, and begin to start integrating their worldview. Because here's the thing, all of life is connected. And college is such an amazing opportunity for students to leverage their influence for the kingdom of God. They don't just have to survive. So my heart was, man, what if they could be influencers who could shape people, who could stand up in class and ask thoughtful questions, who could date in such a way that they bring honor to Christ, are wise in their relationships, wise in their money. I mean, those kind of things, have a vision for that. So they may not read all of it, but if they read some of it, they'll be challenged and encouraged. But this is honestly for parents. Before, if you're a, you know, you have a junior or a rising senior, buy a copy of this book and try to hit a chapter a week with them for the next 40, 45 weeks as they prepare for their senior year and heading off to school. So it's not too late at all to prepare them for that. So that's kind of a general kind of why I wrote Welcome to College.
Yeah, and it's, what I love about the book is it does those two things. Number one, you could read it. If you said, hey, over the summer I have one request of you as my son, read this book. It would do, it'd be great. It would go just a long way toward inoculating and getting and preparing kids to have an impact in college, not just to survive college. But I also love it because the way it's designed is that if I didn't do that, and it was exactly what you said, it was a doorstop, but I encountered a bump in my walk or a challenge that really motivated me. Boy, I wish I had a resource. Yeah, you're right. A half a chapter would at least begin the exploration toward the answer for some of the biggest challenges that people face in college. And I think that's, correct me if I'm wrong, was that really your goal, is to identify what are the challenges that young people face in college and provide responses to those specific challenges we typically face in college?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything from the intellectual challenges to the relational to the spiritual, you know, boundary issues, learning to set boundaries, whether or not it's in a relationship with the opposite sex, or pre-deciding how you're going to respond in tempting situations, whether that comes to alcohol or anything else. And so I wanted to have a realistic, biblical, accessible resource on those things, because there were great books out there on this and that and those particular issues, but I was like, you know, what if they were all in one place? I tried to do my best, and the publisher was generous to allow me to make a little bit of a longer book, but they're short, digestible chapters. There's discussion questions in the back if you're a youth pastor and want to do youth studies on this kind of thing and take them through it. So I really tried to deal honestly with pretty much the stuff that they're going to face. That was my experience. And as I've gotten feedback from students, I just came back from a high school, is they're doing their senior seminar to prepare for college. And it was so encouraging to interact with them about that, so they have kind of a little bit of a map with which to navigate college life, which is really what excites me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so as you go through this, Jonathan, I'm sure that if you're like me, every time you finish a project, you start thinking about what's the next thing that is waiting for Jonathan Morrow. And I kind of started to talk to you about it a little bit. Are you prepared to maybe answer that question today, or is it something you don't want to kind of give away yet? What's the next step in this progression of books you've written so far?
Well, there are some other things in the works. I'm not prepared to share just yet on that. But well, I think there's other issues that we need to engage, and I'm definitely working on some stuff in regards to that, but not quite to the point where I can share anything about it just yet.
Well, so Jonathan, as we get ready to wrap this up today, because you've been very generous with your time as well, but I just want to ask you a question. Of these three books, if I had to pick a book that I was going to give my kids, and I think all three of these are important, of course, I'm kind of inclined toward Welcome to College as a first kind of set, although I think that Think Christianly is far more robust. If you only had one choice here, and I hate to make that choice for you, what would you suggest to parents right now in this season of graduations?
Well, if I only had one choice, I would pick Welcome to College, because it's immediately, everything is immediately accessible. And Think Christianly, because of size constraints, I couldn't get into relational issues. And that's a big part of life in Christianity and college. And so, but I do in Welcome to College. And so I tried to be holistic in that. So if you had just made me pick one, I mean, they would make a great matching set if you wanted all three. But if you just made me pick one, Welcome to College, I think, would be a great graduation gift. And again, I think publishers made it available generously for $5 on Kindle download. So for, I guess, another couple of days, 2 days or so. So
awesome, Jonathan. Thank you so much. I've been speaking this hour with Jonathan Morrow, the founder of ThinkChristianly.org and the author, as we know, who's talked about Welcome to College and Think Christianly, but also another great book out there is God Just a Human Invention and 17 Other Questions Raised by the New Atheist, which he co-wrote with Sean McDowell. Thanks, Jonathan, so much for being a guest on our show today.
Hey, thank you, Jim, and have a great night.
You too, bud. Well, that's it for our show today. Now, listen, there's a lot we could talk about in terms of where your homework might be for this week, but I've tried to post a lot of articles, and so has Melinda online at the STR Talk hashtag. So get over there, look at those articles, and let's get prepared to be able to talk about some of the topics we discussed today here on this radio show. And again, I will commend to you both Welcome to College and Think Christianly for all of your young people who are graduating and getting ready to go on to the next stage of the challenge and being good ambassadors for the gospel. So as we wind up today, let me just say thanks so much to Greg and Melinda and Barbara for helping me stumble through this another week. I guess I can check the box and see I got through it. Somehow I got through it. Thanks, Greg. Get home safely. And the rest of you, go out there this week and give them heaven.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.